rep knows on the ambulatory.
Meeting. I'll probably ask where is it?
Is this the one you and I co-sponsored to?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Beautiful November 16th, and I'll apologize in advance if I talk funnier than I usually talk. It's because I had some dental work that's got my mouth a little screwed up, so I talk pretty weird anyway. I'm going to open an informational hearing and get a report from the Oregon Health Authority on several items. Can I get the OHA team to join us?
Okay.
Nothing to report, I guess. Huh?
No.
Well, that saves the agenda.
The legislative director,
whoever,
was here saying she had to go to the marijuana, but she said that Ms. Saxton was on her way in. Sure.
No. Well, no. We need to wait for Lynn. Why don't we flip the agenda? Since it's also OHA business, and go to the second item, a briefing on the Oregon State Hospital. I saw the boss here today. Can you? Let's do that, if you could join us. Let me just introduce this topic. We are going to be very much involved in mental health things, and in particularly in the issue of the Oregon State Hospital. The committee has not had much of an opportunity to learn about the hospital, and I've asked the director to spend a little time with us sharing the general overview of what goes on there, what the issues are, what you think we need to know, Greg. And so do I have to open another?
No.
It's still OHA business anyway. Why don't you kick it off?
Right. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Greg Roberts. I'm the State Hospital Superintendent. Just finished my fifth year already. It's gone quickly, so happy to be here.
Survived, that's good.
It's a good word. So as Representative Greenlick said, we're here to present some general information about the hospital, to inform the committee, and then talk about some specific issues and to answer any questions. This is John.
For the record, John Swanson, CFO of the Oregon State Hospital. And will this be controlled over there?
No, you control it there.
No.
Okay.
Okay. So we begin with the discussion of the vision and the mission of the hospital. And we do this for a reason, because sometimes this can sound just so rote. But it's a very meaningful thing for the state hospital, given its recent history. If you go back to 2006, when the United States Department of Justice visited the hospital, issued a pretty significantly negative report about the hospital at that time. We've built two new facilities since then, one here in Salem, one in Junction City. We've closed our Portland campus. We closed the Blue Mountain Recovery Center out in Pendleton. And as of earlier this year, we are operating only in Salem and in Junction City.
For the committee members, because of scheduling, we're starting with the state hospital first.
Okay, thank
and
you.
And then we'll go to the general.
Good afternoon. So the reason that we always feel it's significant to talk about the vision and the mission of the hospital is because the deep problems that the hospital was experiencing back in 2006 were representative of the fact that the hospital, in my opinion and in my experience, had lost focus on its vision and lost focus on its mission. But the problems began to overwhelm the hospital's capacity to do what its job was. So in 2010, when I came on board, we decided it was necessary, before we could make any progress at the hospital, we had to refocus on why we exist, what we're here to do, and then to focus on the accomplishment of that mission. So when we talk about those issues, we We are Oregon's only adult psychiatric hospital, and we aim to inspire hope, promote safety, and support recovery for all of our patients. Our mission is to provide therapeutic, evidence-based, patient-centered treatment that focuses on recovery and community reintegration, and to do all that within a safe environment of the hospital. That, again, that's a significant issue because when I began my career 40 years ago, that was not the mission of a state hospital. People who were admitted to a state hospital then could reasonably expect to spend the rest of their life in the state hospital. That was in the mid-1970s when community mental health programs were in their infancy across the country, and people who went to the state hospital were not considered to be there to be treated and discharged because there was not resources in the community to discharge people to. But in the course of time, I'm happy to say, that has changed. So the state hospital's mission is to admit people who cannot be treated in the community, to provide them the treatment and services they need to recover and stabilize and then return to community life in the shortest possible time. So that has been our very clear focus, especially since 2010. We provide intensive psychiatric treatment, as I said, for people who cannot be treated in the community, both civilly committed or criminally committed. Those are people who are adjudicated as guilty except for insanity, or who are in the hospital for evaluation as to their fitness to proceed in the criminal justice system. Those are referred to as 370 patients based on the statute about the ability to aid and assist your defense attorney, and we're going to talk about that specific population in a minute. We provide, obviously, 24-hour on-site care, and we aim to transition people back to the community, which we do. We serve a variety of populations, the civilly committed population, which includes generally when we talk about civilly committed people. These are involuntary commitments for the most part, but some of our patients are voluntarily committed by their guardian. And the criteria for being civilly committed to the state hospital is, first of all, to have a primary diagnosis of mental illness and to be considered imminently dangerous to themselves or to others. And recently a change in the law talks about what some people would generally call grave disability, but people who, by reason of their mental illness, are unable to provide for their own basic needs. We have a neuropsychiatric program. These are about 50% of this population is over the age of 65, have diagnoses of dementia or organic brain injury, other mental illnesses, and often with a significant co-occurring medical problem. So even the people in that portion of the hospital may be younger than 65, but they have significant medical complications as well. Then in the forensic side, we have people who are guilty except for insanity. The initials GEI are usually applied there. These are people who have committed a crime and have been adjudicated through the system and are considered guilty except for insanity. The more serious Measure 11 crimes place people under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Those are Tier 1 offenders, or the Oregon State Hospital Review Panel, which we call SHARP. Those are for the less serious non-Measure 11 offenses. The aid and assist population are also considered part of our forensic program. These are people who have committed an offense in the community, which could be a felony or a misdemeanor, who are considered to be unable, due to their mental illness, to assist their defense attorney in mounting a defense to the charges against them. So they come to the hospital first for evaluation to confirm that they're unable to aid and assist, and then to be restored to competency so that they are able to proceed through the criminal justice system. The treatment, as I said, the main focus of the hospital is to provide treatment to the patients we serve so that they can recover.
You give us some numbers on those four populations.
I do.
Good. Go ahead.
The majority of patients receive their treatment on what we call treatment malls, and I know some of you have been to the hospital and had a tour. You've seen our malls. They look like schools. They're classrooms and group rooms and therapy rooms. Patients, our expectation is that patients attend 20 hours of active treatment in the treatment malls each week, if they're clinically able. If they're not, they receive treatment on the units where they live. But the goal of those on-unit programs is to get people ready to be on the treatment mall. It's like a school day or work day, and the groups focus on preparation for return to the community. Some examples there are vocational rehabilitation, education. We have patients getting their GED. We have some patients even taking online college courses, art therapy, music therapy, mindfulness. We have peer deliver services, which we're very proud of. We have about 10 or 12 employees in our peer recovery specialist department currently. Co-recurring disorders, also very significant since a high percentage of our patients have alcohol or drug problems in addition to their mental illness. The people who prepare the PowerPoint presentations thought it would be a good reminder, again, not that very long ago, Oregon State Hospital was not in the situation that it is today. We were in old, somewhat dilapidated buildings, certainly a non-therapeutic environment to even attempt to provide treatment for our patients. Since then, we have, as I said, built two new facilities in Salem and Junction City. We've resolved all of the USDOJ findings that were cited in the 2006 report. There was a pretty famous 2010 report called the Liberty Healthcare Report that also outlined the significant problems at the state hospital. And if we were to look at the Liberty Healthcare Report today and all of their findings and all of their recommendations, all of the deficiencies that are mentioned in that report have been resolved, and they were resolved actually by 2011 or 2012. The first patients moved into the Salem facility in early 2011, and we were fully moved into the new campus in 2012. At the end of last year, we closed the Blue Mountain Recovery Center out in Pendleton and absorbed their patient population into the Salem campus. And in 2015, in March, earlier this year, we closed the Portland campus of the Oregon State Hospital, which was 72 beds, and opened the Junction City campus with 75 beds in Junction City. These are just some photos of the Salem campus and then the Junction City campus. And the next slide, and this is Representative Greenlick answers the question. Since 2013-2015, this is a summary of the patients we serve numerically and the average census and number of discharges and average length of stay. So currently, today's census, we have 219 guilty except for insanity patients, 186 civil patients, and 191 370 patients. So our census,
two-thirds forensic center.
Yes. Nearly exactly, yes. Our census today is 600, and about 400 of those patients are forensic, yes.
Doesn't give you much flexibility, does it?
Correct. The next slides break out. The first slide is the trend line for the total population of the hospital. So going back to January 2010, it's been a downward trend, and more noteworthy considering that the Blue Mountain population was absorbed into our population in late 2014. So the trend line is down nonetheless. So, but as we'll see in a minute, the nature of the population has changed. The number is decreasing, but the types of patients are changing. This next graph, the guilty except for insanity census trend, is, I think, very significant. A little more than 5 years ago, 339 GEI patients in the state hospital, and today down around 219 today. So this is, I think, representative of many more options for community treatment for people in who are guilty except for insanity. Psychiatric Security Review Board and the State Hospital Review Panel doing an excellent job, I feel, of evaluating patients' readiness for community living and also increasing opportunities for people to live in the community, almost always under close supervision at the time they leave the hospital and then gradually moving on to less secure environments as time goes on. The next slide is the civil population, involuntary civilly committed population. This line, the trend line is upward only because of the absorption of the Blue Mountain Recovery population. So the data before September 2013 does not include the 60 patients who were in Blue Mountain at the time, and then once those patients came to Salem and now Junction City, the number is increased, but it's a little misleading from that point of view.
This is a combination of Salem and Junction City?
It is. The next slide, we've spoken about this in other sessions with this committee and the Ways and Means Committee. This is the 370 population. These are people who are committed an offense in the community, either a felony or a misdemeanor, who are considered as possibly unable to aid and assist their defense, to mount the defense. They come to the state hospital first for evaluation to confirm whether they are or are not able to aid and assist their attorney. And if they are not able to aid and assist their attorney, our job is to provide treatment services that restore them to competency to proceed with their attorney. So this population has had a steady, significant increase over the last 5 years, and especially in this year has grown significantly to the point that today we have 191 370 patients in the hospital. I have. Yeah.
It's kind of puzzling, huh?
Representative Clem has a question.
Well, yeah.
Let me say, for what we should realize is that 40% of the 370 population are in the hospital on misdemeanor charges.
Hmm. So, can we spend just a little time on this one for a second?
Yeah,
so,
please.
Make sure I got it right. These are the people who the court has sent them there for an evaluation?
Correct.
Okay, and are we talking about, and the evaluation's done and they've been adjudicated now to the point where they're there, or are we still just in the evaluation period?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Clement, members of the committee. No, when the evaluation is completed, if there are three possible outcomes, the person is not able to proceed, they're not yet able to assist their attorney, they would remain in the hospital for further treatment and stabilization,
mm-hmm.
or they are able to mm-hmm. assist and they go back to jail. Mm-hmm. And proceed through the criminal justice system, or they are declared as never able, meaning this person will never be able to aid and assist their attorney. Those people also return to the criminal justice system for proceedings, but they're not people who have been adjudicated.
Okay. And these numbers are all three combined?
Able, not able, and never able, yes.
People. These are all three.
Although able people and never able people should be leaving the hospital for the jail.
Okay. So would we be able to find out, if not now, that trend line?
Yes.
I'd like to say for this population was only 66 days on that earlier trial. That's interesting, on that earlier table.
Yeah. I'm, of course, interested in our House Bill 3100 from 2009, and did it have an effect on redirecting people more permanently into the criminal justice system?
Again, Representative Greenlick, Representative Clem, the bill in, there's a more recent bill, 3100 dealt with the 370 population, et cetera. A bill, I don't have the number in front of me, that goes into effect in January, mm-hmm. Requires the judge, before signing a 370 order, must check with the mental health providers in the community setting to determine whether the person can be restored to competency in the community, whether services are available in the community.
So between those two, do we feel like that population's on a decline where there's less people in the hospital long-term who should probably not be there? They should either be in jail or they should be in the community?
In the 370 population?
Yeah.
That's the issue we've been discussing with our community partners recently. We've identified the five or six highest sending admissions. The counties that send the most 370 admissions to the state hospital, again, especially focusing on the 40% who are arrested for misdemeanor charges, mm-hmm. To determine whether services could be developed in the community to provide, to avoid the hospitalization in the first place.
Or prison.
For the felony arrests, probably yes, but for the misdemeanor arrests.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I think, as you know, you may or may not know, I mean, this was a bill I worked on with Representative Tomei, I think, at the time. But the key issue from my perspective was if they're really causing that many problems, it's in my district, I've been there many times, if they're causing problems for everybody else and they really should be in prison and receiving mental health services there at 30 grand a year instead of 200, then that's where they should be. Community's the other option. If they're not really a danger to anybody, that's a good place too. But sometimes we erred on the side of not sending them to prison, and I thought that was a mistake. And that's what the legislature tried to get at. And so we don't want to lose track of that.
Right. For the state hospital's part in the process, a person, let's say they've been arrested for a serious crime, a felony,
yeah.
And they're suspected to be not able to aid and assist their attorney, they'll come to the state hospital first to be evaluated. Are they malingering or are they actually not able to aid and assist their attorney? Mm-hmm. If they're malingering, they go back to jail. If they are not malingering, then our job is to provide services so that they can aid and assist their attorney. The focus is on really legal skills. We call them training about legal skills and the judicial system. And when they're able to return, when they're able to aid and assist their attorney, they return to jail and then proceed through the system. Very few are readmitted to the state.
Representative Hayden?
Yeah.
Chair Greenlee. Thank you for the presentation. It's a subject I'm very interested in. I want to ask a little more definition about your capacity. I see you have a capacity mark here on this. Generally, the rest of the trends, with the exception of the 370 that you're presenting, are trending down. On the capacity, is this physical space or is this the capacity of your current staffing? And your projection has 370 population continuing to rise. Are they going to be filling the space of the areas that are trending down? It seems like those must be physically different spaces in the buildings. How does that work?
Representative Greenlee, Representative Hayden, and members of the committee, correct. The 370 population is only treated in Salem. We don't have 370 patients in Junction City. So the capacity in Salem is 535 beds of the units that are operating. So there's one unit in Salem that is still not open with 26 beds. So the full capacity of Salem would be 561.
With more staffing.
Yes, there's no money in our budget to operate that unit in this biennium. But what you did mention is becoming true, that because the other populations are decreasing, the 370 population is using the bed space that was originally intended for civil patients or GEI patients.
Representative Greenlee, my question doesn't have to do with capacity, so I can wait until the end if you want.
No, go ahead.
Okay, and I'm going to couch my question that I'm not implying anything as far as the hospital. We had a very tragic incident in my neighborhood, in my community yesterday, and I've had a lot of citizens and people ask me about mental health and how we treat it in this state. So the question has to do, and early on you talked about recovery, and I guess I just need to get a better sense of what that means and how do we determine somebody has recovered, because that's the kind of questions I'm now being asked given this incident in my community.
Representative Greenlee, Representative Lively, and members of the committee. Recovery in general for our purposes, for this discussion, I think would mean when the criteria for civil commitment, as I said earlier, the primary diagnosis of mental illness and danger to self or others or inability to provide basic care needs. When a person no longer meets those criteria, they are considered to no longer require state hospital level services, but they likely do require services that can be provided and should be provided in the community. When we, in the state hospital, when we talk about recovery, we basically talk about enabling a person to be ready for that next less intense level of service.
So, thank you.
All right, can you talk about personnel for a bit? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Yeah. There's been repeated criticism from the Department of Justice for our lack of community-based mental health care services and our lack of progress from an institutional-based system. Can you update us where we are in that process and addressing the concerns of the Department of Justice?
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. I apologize for being delayed, but the good news is Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. The good news is that you got to hear from Director Roberts, who does an outstanding job for Oregonians at the State Hospital. I want to talk about a couple things. First, specifically to Representative Buehler's question about criticism for the department from the Department of Justice. We are currently concluding a three-year process of negotiations with the U.S. Department of Justice about Oregon's need to find new solutions for severely emotionally disturbed people in the community. And that work will culminate, and we'll actually talk to you today about some of the work we're doing to build that capacity in communities. It is really critical, and Director Roberts is not good at bragging about some of the gains he has made at the state hospital. And I'm also here to talk about some of the very real challenges we face right now in Oregon. We have a growing 370 population, and this morning had the second in a series of data conference calls with the counties that we have begun to initiate discussion about what resources are on the ground for this population in their communities, what they need in terms of assistance from the Oregon Health Authority to get those resources in place. And we're not just talking physical resources, we're talking about skilled and trained staff. And we're hopeful that in that process, we will both identify the capacity in the counties around the state. That work is already underway, and some work I'll talk to you about a little later. But also to really get to the concrete numbers we need to be able to serve in Oregon today. The county we were speaking to has very real challenges right now with an expanding homeless population and the increasing percentage of those individuals who are both uninsured and also not getting any kind of regular health care. So our hope is through two factors for the Oregon Health Authority and specifically for the state hospital. Number one, we're going to be completing an agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice about what a community-based system looks like and what criteria it needs to meet to pass muster, importantly for them, but more importantly for Oregonians. And second, we're going to be having very concrete and data-driven conversations with the counties where we have a significant number of 370 referrals to the state hospital. That number is not declining. It puts significant pressure on our budget, on our operating protocols. And at the end of the day, many of those people do not need to be in the state hospital. They can be served in lower levels of care if those capacities exist in our counties. So I'm going to turn it over to you, but I just wanted to share the very real serious news that we have tremendous work here to do. And we're approaching that work seriously and with a sharp focus on the next 6 months, not the next 6 years. We need to have some real solutions in place, given that the state hospital is general fund funded. And equally important that many of these individuals, for their misdemeanors, do not belong in the state hospital, and it's not the best place for their needs to be met. Now, concurrent with that is an ongoing discussion that we are going to have about...
Was there an answer to your question?
Does that answer
somewhere buried in there?
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Representative Bueller, does that... We're happy to expand on that in more detail.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Can we spend a couple of minutes talking about your personnel, and then we'll move on to the first agenda item with the...
Absolutely. And let me just say, I'll do my best to brag about the hospital in about a minute. So. Yeah. Staffing, is it? I'm sorry, Representative Green, your question is about staffing?
Yeah, I think where you were about to go.
Yes. So, again, for the committee to be aware, about 81% of the state hospital's budget is related to staff salaries and taxes and benefits. We are budgeted in this biennium for 2,224 staff, for that's total for Salem and Junction City. 71% of our staff are provide direct care. Examples are here, nurses, psychiatrists, et cetera. And our unit staffing, this was a development, this I can brag here. Last year, about a year and a half ago, based on very careful data collection, data analysis, we were able to identify by unit and by shift appropriate staffing ratios. So we have been abiding by those ratios, and that the bragging there is because other states have now called us and are looking to replicate the process that we engaged in as well. So we are meticulous about, we monitor our staffing every day in terms of the ratios that have been established and the use of overtime, especially to meet those ratios.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? There, maybe a year ago, we asked some questions about the relationship that you had with OHSU for part-time psychiatrists or your memorandum of understanding. Has that come up for review again, or has there been any change in that?
Representative Greenlick, Representative McKenney-Geyer, the contract for OHSU expired in June, and we're living under an extension at this point, still in negotiations with OHSU in the contract.
Hmm.
Okay. Right. Greg, let me ask you one question about staffing.
Right. In terms of staffing, one of the questions that comes up in terms of staffing is our overtime use. Our overtime in the past few months has been increasing related to the 370 issue. It's a very labor-intensive population for us. People often come from correctional facilities, pretty unstable, unmedicated, and not engaged in any treatment. So especially at the beginning of their hospitalization, they're often on one-to-one or two-to-one supervision for us. So that's been an overtime driver.
I think that raises where I wanted to go. You want to? We always hear from your staff about patient safety concerns. Will you just talk a little bit? I mean, that's, I'm sure, a constant ongoing thing in the state psychiatric hospital.
Representative Greenlick, again, an opportunity to brag a bit, or at least point out some successes we've been having. We have focused, and we talked about this in previous committee sessions, on staff education, staff training, staff competency issues, and collaborative problem solving specifically. We've trained hundreds of staff at this point in collaborative problem solving and hired coaches on certain units to ensure that the staff employ the methodology correctly. We've seen a downturn in incidents of violence. We've seen a downturn in patient-to-staff assaults and degree of injury. I can provide that information separately to the committee. It's an issue. Well, you'll never have me here saying that we've resolved that issue. Any assaults, any violence, any injuries to patients or staff is unacceptable to us. But we have we've seen a downturn. Some of our units have seen a 40% to 50% reduction in the use of seclusion and restraint, which is often where people are injured in the process. So some good news there.
You have a final word for us? We'll be hearing from you again, I guarantee you.
Well, I do. And the state hospital was visited in March or April by the Joint Commission. It's formerly called the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. It's actually an international organization that establishes standards that determine, that basically describe, the standards collectively describe an excellent healthcare facility. We passed our Joint Commission survey with flying colors, and especially on our performance improvement initiatives, our system. A context of this is 6-7 years ago when the hospital was in such serious problems. One of the issues that I found when I came on board as a superintendent was that there was not a robust culture that attacked the problems that were there. There's a lot of talking and a lot of committees, but there wasn't a lot of action. So we adopted a mentality to say we don't need consultants to endlessly come into the state hospital and tell us what's wrong. We need to start resolving the problems and to understand that we can fix the problems ourselves. So we've been doing that using lean methodology for 5 or 6 years now. And the Joint Commission was so impressed with our performance improvement initiatives and the accomplishments that we've been able to document that they've recommended we apply for a Baldrige Award of Excellence. Mm-hmm. And we're in the process of studying the criteria for that. We have a few staff working on that. And if we achieve, it will take two to three years to work through the process because there are lower stages of awards before you can get to the national award. But if we are successful, and I think we can be, then Oregon State Hospital will be the first and only state hospital in the United States to achieve the Baldrige Award. So that's where we're headed. So,
well, thank you very much. Well,
thank you.
We'll be seeing you again on a regular basis, I'm sure. Sorry. Representative Crum.
I just wanted
you
to
get a final question because you represent them, right?
Really quick. Hmm? You know, I was served on that special committee, I think it was a freshman maybe, special committee to deal with these DOJ issues, and to see where you've gone from then to now is really quite remarkable. And the fact that I don't hear as much, I know means you're doing a good job, because I heard all the time. It's why I was sneaking around playing intern and doing my own little studies out there. But the fact that I don't hear complaints hardly ever is really quite extraordinary.
It's a great team. Well, yeah, I always use the analogy. I think the superintendent should always be seen as an orchestra conductor. Mm. I'm conducting a pretty good orchestra, so that's how it's happening.
Great.
So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Lynn, you're on with the first, your next team. Any slides or no?
Further on, we have some slides. Probably not at the outset.
Turn the light up now then.
The first two.
I got the lights back on.
I know, that's why you don't like how it
Go for it.
Okay.
I think you need to reintroduce yourself.
Yes. Represent Chair Greenlick, Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. With me today is Lori Koiner, who is our Director of Health Analytics. We have a lot of things to present to you on today, and we're happy to go in whatever order the committee would like to proceed. So I defer to you all.
Keep going your order.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to start talking about the waiver then, because we're forward-looking and working hard on the 2017 waiver. This is a really critical step for Oregonians as we move forward to the next phase, what we like to call it, the Oregon Health Authority Health System Transformation 2.0. Oregon's current waiver is in the third year of its 5-year demonstration period that launched the coordinated care model based on the triple aim of better health, better care at lower costs. Our health care policy is now a national model with the endorsement of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and other states have approached Oregon expressing interest in replicating the coordinated care model in their states. Our delivery system transformation framework includes the integration of oral, behavioral health, and physical health, moving away from fee-for-service reimbursement to value-based payments, and is committed to local control and governance, founded on patient-centered primary care. also seeks to advance health equity and moves beyond medical services to more effectively address our members' needs by connecting to public health, early education, housing, and other social determinants of health. Recently, the Oregon Health Authority was invited to Seattle to present to the head of Medicaid and Medicare services on the implications of the coordinated care model, what was working, and what we viewed as why we had been successful to date. And it was an honor to present. It was also an honor to be clear about the challenges that are before us. We have not completed our work in the coordinated care model, although we have made significant advances. Our current waiver period ends June 30th, 2017. States are encouraged to start the next waiver planning 1 year in advance of renewal. That work is well underway. There is a significantly large Gantt chart with multiple deliverables from literally hundreds of participants throughout the Oregon Health Authority, and we are confident we will complete that work on schedule. It will, of course, involve all of our stakeholders, so there will be stakeholder meetings with not only the CCOs, but our list of stakeholders, which is several hundred strong, and we'll be talking to people. We're already talking to the tribes and to drug and alcohol people about what are the opportunities for the forthcoming waiver and what are the challenges, quite frankly, for the forthcoming waiver. The current waiver, with its key stakeholders today, has agreed to a waiver amendment to extend the Hospital Transformation Performance Program. This will be a topic of conversation with CMS. We're also going to be identifying policy changes to advance progress on an integrated global budget, facilitate greater utilization of flexible service, and continue the progress through the greater use of alternative payments at the provider service level. With the approval of the amendments, we're going to pursue an expedited 2017 waiver process identified by CMS to extend for another 5 years. And post that 2017 waiver approval, we will be pursuing amendments starting in 2015, improving member access with focus on developing the workforce. The Oregon Health Policy Board has a very active, engaged workforce committee right now working on some of the barriers to workforce expansion. We're going to improve care and lower costs through looking at a substance use disorder waiver, and we'll be seeking policy changes to improve the quality and integration of the behavioral health system most specifically, which I'll be outlining the preliminary framework for you today, as well as increasing the integration of oral and population health into the coordinated care model. It's important to note that this work has just begun. We have been fortunate at the Oregon Health Authority for the last 7 months. We've had four vacant executive positions. This week, for the first time, we have a full executive team, and the last hire, which we will complete in December, will be our new Medicaid director. Leslie Clement has been fulfilling the Medicaid director responsibilities, which are fairly detailed and intense, as well as director of the Oregon policy and analytics, health policy and analytics team. So much work left to come, lots of dialogue to occur with you. I know many of you have ideas on things that need to be incorporated in the waiver, but I wanted to let you know that the preliminary meetings we've had with CMS have occurred, and we are on track with a very rigorous work plan over the course of the next year. I also would like to touch briefly on the Section 1332 waiver, which is also sometimes referred to as the as a Wyden waiver, after our very own senator. And the it's important to note that the director of DCBS, Pat Allen, and I have a meeting coming up to talk about 1332 waivers and what they look like and what they mean and what opportunity exists for Oregon that we're not currently taking advantage of. We haven't had that meeting yet, but we will keep you all apprised as we convene and look at that opportunity. It is also important to note that Director Allen and I have initiated what we are calling the Health Finance Coordinating Council. There have been intensifying issues in the healthcare marketplace over the last 60 or 90 days with some crossover between our two agencies. So our CFOs have convened and we're creating a charter and an operating agreement with DCBS so that we can jointly be proactive in addressing health finance issues. And again, that group has not yet convened. We're getting the logistics in place, but we're excited about the opportunity to share expertise where appropriate. I'm going to pause there. That's what I brought today to talk to you about the waiver. I'm very interested in hearing anything that you, Chair Greenlick, or members of the committee would like to talk about further with waivers. Again, with the note that our new Medicaid director will be starting in mid-December.
You want to comment at all on the basic health plan? We'll keep that to meeting because it sort of fits into this waiver question.
I think you're going to have tests. There's a committee test, and I think we've submitted our documents. I don't think I have anything else to add on the basic health plan at this point.
Any other questions on this before we move on?
Briefly describe the 1332 waiver.
I can't because I'm just becoming expert on it. But I will be able to describe it, and I'll send this committee an email after we've had our first meeting. I've just been
the waiver that allows state agencies. It's a program that allows state agencies to put in waivers both for the Medicaid and for the marketplace population beginning in 2017.
Right.
And we're going to have one of our proposed. Legislative concepts will be a way to try and crystallize that. I've talked both to Director Allen and to the administrator about making sure we know which way we're going and how it's going to be handled.
I have two dental-related questions. Is now a good time to ask them or no?
Dental-related questions. It's always a good time for you.
I have two dental-related questions.
Yes.
One, there was a bill that we put forth to help OHA identify hopefully providers for pregnant women under the poverty level of 185. Do you have anything to report back on that? And secondly, we also did some changes, which I think were approved through Ways and Means, to bring back some denture, wisdom tooth extractions, some oral health issues that do you have an update on that?
So I don't have the data on the providers for pregnant women, but I will get that for you. I just didn't have that on my team's radar today, but we will get that information. I know you and Representative Kenny Guyer are very
interested. Sure, that's through the committee, and we'll
bring it to the committee. So we do have data. With regard to the dental procedures, we had, I believe there was a meeting in the last week. We did not, the Oregon Health Authority did not participate in those discussions, so we've asked for clarification of the benefit, and as soon as we get clarification of the benefit, we'll be able to identify the cost and proceed with rulemaking to implement. Again, that was something that occurred, I think, at the end of session, and we just need what was agreed to. In the last meeting, our chief dental officer was not in the meeting either, and so we have kind of gaps in communication, but we have asked for that information. As soon as we get it, we'll proceed to rulemaking.
I'll keep asking.
Well, if you have a description of the benefit, that would help me. If anyone, I mean, not being a dental expert, but if you could just tell me what was agreed to, we're happy to.
I can do that.
Thank you. Later. That would be great.
Okay, next topic.
Next topic. We are very excited today to just share an outline of where we're going on behavioral health. We have been working intensely for the last 7 months, and we'll be bringing a proposal forward to the governor. I want to just kind of go through the framework of that at this point. Our goal is to create a vision and an action plan for improving Oregon's behavioral health, and I want to be clear that when we say behavioral health, which is the phrase we've been encouraged to use by many stakeholders, we're talking about mental health, drug, and addictions treatment. So our goal is to create an action plan for improving Oregon's behavioral health performance and outcomes. Currently, Oregon has many high-quality behavioral health services and professionals across the state. In addition, we have, as you have just heard, a state hospital that may be the best state hospital in the country, though it is funded entirely by general fund dollars. However, we also have sectors of behavioral health services that may be operating under significant resource constraints. And we have other sectors that offer continuums of care for various populations. However, these continuums and their coherency and scope of services vary widely throughout the state. You can be in a part of the state where best practice is not fully available in the continuum of care for the population of need, and that's an area of critical concern for us. Health system transformation at its core envisions integrated services, which occur in some settings. I would cite the patient-centered primary care home in Enterprise, Oregon, is doing a terrific job of blending physical and behavioral health, but other parts of the state do not have such integrated systems. Integration of physical, behavioral, and oral health services is critical to the success of health system transformation and the health of Oregonians. It must include an assessment of the transition and discharge hydraulics of the system. One of the critical areas that we are just not hitting on all cylinders right now is a patient may receive a quality episode of care but may not get to the next level of care successfully, so causing us to go back to the beginning and start over. This is just a starting point for the problems that we see and for which we will want to identify solutions. We are taking the following actions to begin this discussion. First of all, we need a comprehensive assessment of the scope of Oregon's need for services, the locations, quality, and outcomes of the services we have, and most critical, the required financial structure and level of support for sustainability and measurable gains for the population receiving services. After we complete this quantitative and qualitative assessment, we must create a process of data collection, discussion, solution identification, and implementation planning with measurable outcomes and timelines. Currently, the Technical Advisory Committee has met once for the behavioral health mapping tool that the Oregon Health Authority designed 6 months ago. The committee's first meeting, the committee is comprised of people from around the state who are experts in the field, who are experts on research, who are experts on data integrity, and the first meeting went exceedingly well, principally because people were very excited to take a data-driven look at what is needed to meet Oregon's behavioral health needs. We already see in that data some very good news and some very alarming news, and before we draw conclusions and improve our system to meet those needs, we need to ensure the integrity of the data. We don't want to run off without being sure we have the right data. So that committee is meeting. They have a timeline for completion. The tool is somewhere between 80 and 85% complete, and we look forward to completing it before June of 2016. We also have been taking significant efforts to make progress, and I'd like to just summarize the progress made to date by the Oregon Health Authority. We are nationally recruiting a behavioral health director who will lead policy development with us, with the Health Policy and Analytics Division. That national recruitment is particularly looking for skill and talent in delivering the outcomes that we know are necessary in Oregon. We have consolidated DMAP and AMH in the new Health Systems Division. Dr. Varsha Shahan began her work 2 weeks ago. Regretfully, she's in Portland today, but I hope you'll get to meet her in the next 2 days. She comes to us with a background in health system transformation and operations management. We have created, as I already mentioned, a behavioral health resource data platform for the state. I want to underscore that this data is compiled not just for the CCOs, which, of course, are a cornerstone of our system, but also for the counties across Oregon who deliver behavioral health services on a daily basis in some of the most critical situations we face, and they often deliver those services to people who are not enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, but people who have private insurance or no insurance. We are convening, I believe, next week with all 16 behavioral health directors of the coordinated care organizations. This is a starting point for our discussion with them about what is currently working in health system transformation and where our opportunities for expansion and improvement are, and I'm looking forward to that conversation. We have recruited a county commissioner. Commissioner Karen Joplin from Hood River has joined the Oregon Health Policy Board. She's attended two meetings and also is serving a very critical purpose of bringing the county perspective and the behavioral health perspective to the discussion of health policy in Oregon. We competed for a $734,000 federal grant supporting existing behavioral health initiatives, and we achieved that grant, and we are currently allocating $20 million in housing that this legislature awarded to the Housing Authority and to the Oregon Health Authority to ensure that mental health housing is strategically developed. It's critical to note that we're using some of the data we've compiled for the behavioral health tool to help us make those investments in a strategic manner. We are completing a statewide behavioral health tour, working with Senator Sarah Gelser, and we will have a summary report of that tour in January. We've completed five of those meetings. The attendance, most recently we were in Albany, Oregon. There were about 160 behavioral health consumers in the room, and I think we're very excited to bring data to this committee and to the legislature from those meetings. It will not be a narrative report, but it will be a summary of the conversations we are hearing from users in the system. And one of the things all of us have come away from those experiences with different reactions and different educational reactions, but one of the things that is most telling is as we've spent time in those communities, no surprise to many of us who've worked with behavioral health issues, is that many of those people are really focused on the need for employment, the need for relationships, social relationships that are not structured government relationships, but social relationships, and the critical need for a continuum of care as opposed to a series of episodes of care. Those discussions have been very robust, and we look forward to bringing that report to you. We have collaborated on the development of the Unity Project in Portland, and we are in, as I mentioned previously, the final stages of negotiating a successful agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. Our attorneys are still hard at that work, but I think that agreement which we reach will provide a really solid foundation for decision-making in Oregon. As you know, the U.S. Department of Justice is not a fan of state hospitals. They are very much looking to Oregon to expand our community capacity to serve those with behavioral health issues, and we think we will have a solid platform for doing so. And finally, we have deployed Serve Oregon for the first time ever. This is a crisis intervention tool developed by our public health department, and we had not had the opportunity to try it out. One of the things, tragically, is that in Oregon we had the opportunity to try it out by the events at UCC in Roseburg. And so at the request of Douglas County, both county commissioners and the CCO in Douglas County and other community leaders, legislators, and Congress people, we have deployed Serve Oregon, which is a deployment using public health funds, emergency funds, of mental health professionals to the Douglas County community to support the capacity they need of mental health professionals on the ground in Roseburg. So that includes psychologists, therapists, etc. And we began work a week ago on the ground in Roseburg. These people move to Roseburg for 2-week cycles and make sure that everyone who needs attention, whether they're a victim's family, a first responder, that they get it in a timely manner. Part of our experience and the experience nationally is that oftentimes in tragedies such as occurred in Roseburg, the people come in for 30 days and then a lot of the real trauma is felt and there aren't sufficient resources. So we will be on the ground in Roseburg for 8 weeks to support the local professionals. I want to underscore that it is to support The model is not one where we drive the community process, but we simply are there to be available. The team has reported on Friday of last week that it's going well, that they're enthusiastic, and the model is such that these people are specifically trained and act every day on kind of a huddle-up model where they talk about what they're learning and adjust what they're doing to the specific circumstances of Roseburg. So we're very pleased for that, and we'll be bringing you a report both of how we did in terms of serving the very critical needs that we have in Douglas County, but also how we did in our first launch of this model, which is designed to serve many public emergencies. And this is our first one, and it's a behavioral health emergency. So we're going to use it as a learning tool for the agency. As I mentioned previously, we are opening discussions with the counties on behavioral health issues. We have five counties we're working with right now on the 370 population, and that is a fruitful discussion. We have much work left to do, working with the judiciary, the district attorneys, the hospitals, and the stakeholders as we move forward with behavioral health solutions for Oregon. I want to mention briefly that the plan is for the Oregon Health Authority to come forward with a two-year proposal for immediate gains that we think can be made in the behavioral health system. We'll be finalizing and developing that plan and bringing it to Governor Brown. We are very optimistic that there are additional solutions to be had in the behavioral health sector. That's from our preliminary review of the behavioral health mapping tool, which shows us some very clear opportunities and also some very real success stories that could be replicated around the state. It also has been very helpful for us to get a crisp view of the investments in behavioral health around Oregon, both the federal investments, the state investments, both county and CCO, and we'll be bringing forward some ideas in that space. So that's where we are in the first 9 months, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about behavioral health.
It's a field you've had some experience with, and I noted Greg's mission at the state hospital is to inspire. You've had a chance to think about this over the years, and more specifically as administrator. Do you think we can create a working community mental health system in this state?
I do. There have been tremendous advances made in behavioral health in the last decade in this country, both advances in interventions that are data-driven and evidence-based and successful. There also has been tremendous advancements in terms of diagnostic capability. And I firmly believe that if we use the resources we have, if we use the data we have, and we significantly focus on developing the workforce that is needed in the 21st century for behavioral health solutions, that we can have an effective community-based system supported by, I'll just be clear here, when I came into this work 13 years ago, everyone thought there would never need to be another residential child placed, and we will always need secure facilities for children and adults who are at risk of danger to themselves or others. So I would disclose that bias on my part. Yes, we can have a community.
We'll be
system.
Here to help you.
Thank you.
It's something we're very much concerned.
It's very exciting.
Yes.
Chair Greenlee, I just wanted to make a comment. House District 7 is where Umpqua Community College is, and so I've been involved with that a lot. And I want to thank you for being personally involved in many, many of those conversations and phone calls, and just the, aggressiveness or the responsiveness that the Oregon Health has had to make sure that they can do everything they can down there. I appreciate that.
Thank you. It's been a privilege to work with the community. We will be in Roseburg on December 1st. Continuing to work, but it's been a privilege to be part of that community. Thank you.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlee. Very complex problem to address behavioral health in the state. And considering the advances we've seen nationally that you referred to, help me define what the problem is in Oregon, where we continually are ranked at one of the lowest quality behavioral health systems in the country, one of the highest suicide rates in the entire country. I think before we really leap into solving the problem, we need to accurately define what it is. Can you provide any insight to that?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I think I can provide a little insight, and then we have work underway to carefully define the problem, because specifically the suicide rate and the national ranking of Oregon does not reflect some of the fine work that's going on in the state today. I do believe we have several problems, several challenges before us right now. One is we have to look at the interventions and services we're operating in the context of the funding. You can't implement 21st century interventions without tying the money to what you're getting for the money. And that sometimes requires a very uncomfortable look about what has always been done but may not need to be done anymore. So we did not want, out of respect to the people in the profession and the people doing the work across the state, we didn't want to have that conversation without data, and we're going to have that data. Secondly, I think we have a very unique opportunity in Oregon because of our metrics that we stood up in the physical health care space to use that to address some of what people have referred to in the past in Oregon as the quagmire of behavioral health. I think too often we decide that it's just impossible, that it just can't be any better, that it's just overwhelming. And how do we really address the fact that 20% of our children today need a behavioral health support in order to be successful in their schools and in their communities? So I think, first of all, we're going to look at new interventions. That's a critical piece. Second, we're going to look at the money, the ROI, if you will. Third, we're going to look at 21st century best practices in terms of outcomes. And part of that discussion, I know, which from my own experience is sometimes very difficult to have with families, is and with adults, is what does the future hold? And for me, I have seen many times where if people can have a clear conversation about what mental health and mental illness and behavioral health means, and what are the realistic chances of success for recovery, if families and people who care about people with behavioral health challenges have very candid conversations, often the solutions are easier to find. Having a candid conversation is not always possible, and that's part of what we're going to have to begin to do, is talk about what's realistic and what's going to happen.
Just a quick follow-up.
Very briefly, yes.
Who's going to be responsible for developing this plan, and what's the timeline?
We're going to give a framework of the plan to the governor. The time frame is, I think, for that discussion is months, not years. I don't have a precise date to give you today. And then we have begun our national search for a behavioral health director who has experience in transforming behavioral health systems, and that's a high priority hire for us. So I expect that to happen in months, not years either. It's important to note for this committee that in our recruitments for the four vacant executive positions we've had extremely robust responses and very high caliber people applying because of the coordinated care model. The word is out. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about it enough perhaps in Oregon, but Oregon is now a national model that professionals are excited about. So I'm going
to give you the chance to talk about it right now. Can you move into what issue? How are you doing on the CCO side?
Oh, okay. So CCO side.
You have about 10 minutes.
Perfect. I'm going to give you a copy of a letter that my foot's asleep. Can you give that? Thank you. I'm going to give you a copy of a letter that we received Friday evening from CMS. I do want to say that I did get an email while I was in the building today, which included a number of questions from Family Care. I want to underscore that we are currently in mediation with Family Care, so I will not be responding to those questions today.
Fine. We also want at least 1 minute on public health. I forgot.
I know, and I was ready to go there next, so I'm ready. Okay, so this is the letter. Okay, I'll just have one. I'll let you read. Do you need another copy?
Well, how many letters do we have?
Go on, it's all right.
Okay, I'll make copies.
Thank you. I apologize. This came Friday evening.
Okay.
Effectively, where we are right now with the CCOs is, first of all, I want to thank them for their work, their hard work over the last year. It's been a pleasure to partner with them. We have 15 signed contracts for the redeveloped 2015 rates. We have sent out the 2016 rates on November 9th, and the CCOs have 60 days to review those rates. Those discussions, we have work sessions individually with every CCO to work through and answer their questions on those rates. Those conversations are underway, and Ms. Coyner is happy to address that specifically. As this letter shows, we are completing our process with CMS in terms of the 2015 rates, and there are a lot of good words in here about Oregon's success in redeveloping 2015 rates and preparing for our 2016 methodology. I feel that all of the hard work of the last 9 months is paying dividends in that many of the stakeholders have a much clearer view. I'm very proud of the fact that this year we got those contracts out 60 days in advance as opposed to on Christmas Eve. And I think we have a solid platform. Perhaps this is certainly most important to me. In order for the health system transformation to continue and actually to accelerate and expand to further integration of behavioral, oral, and physical health, we need a solid methodology for rates going into 2016. I think the hard work of the CCOs and our team over the last 9 months is going to pay those dividends, and I'm very excited about that. So with that, I'll stop, and we have a brief PowerPoint.
Yeah, do you mind?
Nope.
The 2016 rates were developed with the methodology we talked about when we were here the last time.
Yes, sir.
What do I need to do to click this?
I would assume.
Sorry. Okay, I got it. Okay.
For the record, I'm Lori Coyner, Director of Health Analytics with the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm just going to give a very brief update on where we are with rates. As Director Saxton just mentioned, 15 of the 16 CCOs signed the amended contracts with their 2015 revised rates. 14 of the CCOs requested that all their recoupments and additional payments be reconciled by the end of 2015. So there's been lots of discussion around recoupments. I do want to point out that 10 CCOs received more dollars, 6 have some type of recoupment, but also it varies greatly between the expansion population and the non-expansion. So it's a lot more complicated, and I'm happy to provide totals and numbers in terms of where the dollars shift if requested. We did have one CCO. We did ask the CCOs that if they were going to have a financial difficulty in having the recoupment occur by the end of 2015, one CCO did request to go beyond that. So we are working with them on a individual basis to spread out their recoupment time period into 2016. As Director Saxton mentioned, also on Friday we received a letter from CMS. It's in front of you now, that indicates that after receiving more additional information, that they are expected to approve the revised 2015 rate ranges. And so that's the update on 2015. I'm going to move on to the next slide. For 2016, the 2016 contracts were delivered to CCOs for a 60-day review. The contract rate sheets, so that the official forms that contain the 2016 rates were delivered to CCOs on November 2nd. The full contracts were delivered, I believe, on November 9th. The 2016 rates and certification have been delivered to CMS for review and approval. That is as of today. The actuary signed the certification on Friday, and we've delivered the package for review and approval to CMS today. And there, the certification and the rates will be posted on our website within the next day, now that they're official and signed and sent to CMS. The 2016 rates...
So, CMS is approving them?
Excuse me?
CMS actuary signs it?
Oh, no. Representative Greenlick, our consulting actuary, Zach Adder, signed on Friday. The 2016 rates met the sustainable rate of growth when compared to the revised 2015 rates. There was an overall state increase of 2.8%, and that left 0.6% for the increase in the quality pool. In 2016, the quality pool, which you'll recall is the incentive payment program, will be up to 5% of the 2016 expenditures. Next slide. The graphic in front of you just shows at the state level and then the four different rating regions what the increases both for the ACA and non-ACA were, comparing the revised 2015 rates to the 2016 rates. And this final slide is just to demonstrate the state's share of the budget of the 2015 to 2017 biennial budget relative to the federal match. You'll see that it says 1% is a state share for the ACA group, and that's just because the beginning in 2017, the state starts paying, you know, I believe 5%. So. And that's all I have, unless there are questions.
And that 36% state share from the ACA, non-ACA, that comes from both general fund and from the hospital tax. Is that right? That's the main source of that.
Correct.
Is there any questions?
A question.
Representative Hayden, please.
Chair Greenlee. Going forward into 2017 rate setting process, will it be pretty consistent with the 2000 what you're doing now, or do we kind of expect a bump along the road? How much consistency will there be going forward?
Representative Greenlick and Representative Hayden, we expect there to be consistency. We spent lots of time and effort on the 2015 process in order to get a solid base and foundation. However, we will be working on some pieces to improve the process. So, for example, how better to incorporate flexible spending and encourage flexible spending by the CCOs as part of the global budget would be one example.
I certainly hope you're planning on risk adjusting the ACA population in 2017.
That will happen for 2017.
Yeah, so it's not really the same. That's a pretty significant difference.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I think we just want to further share that when we met with CMS in Baltimore probably 3 weeks ago now, one of the things that they have consistently said is the hard work done in 2015 in creating a methodology supports us as we go forward into the process, and that the rate decision process itself gets more expeditious once you're on a methodology that is clear to them and supported by them.
But the hard work, put a risk adjustment model in place for 10 of the 13 rate categories.
Yes.
I hope one didn't infer from anything they said that you should not do that same thing now that you have the data for the other three.
No, that's correct. So We feel like we're on a good, sustainable path. I also just want to point out, and we'd be happy to leave you with this as well, but one of the questions that came up, has come up consistently and was part of our original direction to Optimus when we hired them to be our actuaries for this process, is the critical concern that health system transformation continue. And so we've prepared for you a chart today that shows the evolution of health system transformation in Oregon, the savings, the number of people, the advances, and it's our expectation that we continue those gains going forward. And as the letter from CMS indicates, we have every ability to do so.
So I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know I've asked you several times about how we can avoid being in a situation where retroactively we're readjusting rates downward for some groups. And the thought I've had is, if you don't know exactly, you're guessing what the risk score is for your population for the year in advance. And if that does change, you know, it would be nice to be able to move CCOs up and to correct it up rather than have them take a hit, and maybe to have some kind of reserve for that, so it's not just embedded in their own reserves and you've got some winners and losers from their own reserves, but that you have some set aside for that. Has there been any discussion about that beyond the conversations I've had with people?
Do you want to answer first?
Sure. Representative Greenlip and Representative Kenny Geyer, there has not been a discussion about a separate withhold, but I can explain a couple of things where we do, in fact, take that into account. So one of the additions to the methodology that was developed by Optimus was there's a 10%, 8-10% administrative cost that's built in, and then also a 1% risk margin. That is it's a contingency. So that gives another 1% kind of as a just in case there are new services that come into play or there's other kinds of unexpected changes throughout the year. The other piece to recall is in 2016, there will be up to 5% of their dollars held in the quality pool payments, and so those are paid out separately from the capitation as well.
So just to follow up, so I understand that the quality dollars are set aside and will be distributed retroactively to those that meet certain performance goals, but the other piece that you're talking about, the set aside, the 1% and the 5-8% administrative, is what you've set aside in advance so that they have a buffer, they have increased reserve in case their expenses are more or whatever. But what I'm saying is, can you also add another 1% or whatever is needed as a set aside for the whole pool so that you're not relying on them to be eating into their own buffer or coming out ahead?
Representative Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer, we have not pose that idea with the CCOs. I imagine that they will be worried about cash flow if we withhold more dollars. I think that would be a concern.
Okay.
Can we move to the public health?
Yes, sir.
Very briefly. I see Michael lurking back there. Here he comes.
Is he here?
Michael, yay. Here we go.
So Michael Tynan from the Public Health Division. Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to present on public health modernization. I think we have some different slides. Public health modernization was structured around several foundational capabilities and foundational programs that were developed by the task force in the future of public health. So we have had a collaborative effort since House Bill 3100 was passed and put many of the task force recommendations into statute. And local and state public health have been working since June on defining those foundational capabilities and programs. The way I describe it is the task force and the bill define things at 30,000 feet. We've been asked to bring them down to ground level and operationalize them. So we've been engaged in that for the past 4 or 5 months. And what those definitions are going to do is they're going to drive an assessment that's going to occur across the public health system. So we are in the process now of developing an assessment out of those definitions. The assessment will occur January, February, March. The results of the assessment will be due in March. We will then analyze those results. So we'll have definitions. We'll do an assessment across the system, figure out where state and local public health are at achieving foundational capabilities and programs, and then be able to analyze the results and report back to the legislature per House Bill 3100 in June of 2016. We are also in the process of seating a public health advisory board, a new public health advisory board that will start in January. This will be the board that will provide the metrics on how we'll measure progress for public health modernization. They'll also provide guidance and oversight to the division on issues like our statewide health improvement plan and other objectives that we have. The report that we will provide in June 2016 will include findings both from the public health division and from county health authorities related to modernization, how we are at each level at achieving each of the foundational capabilities and each of the foundational programs. The report will also include an estimate of the resources needed to fully fill that gap that we identify for each foundational capability and each foundational program. And after we produce the report, we also plan to continue to look at our results and conduct an analysis that will allow us to report on estimates of outcomes of diseases averted, lives saved, healthcare costs saved, if we were to achieve foundational capabilities in each one of the programs. So the key takeaway, I'm trying to sum this up really quickly, is that we want you to know that we're on timeline, we're on our timeline, we're on progress to meeting all of our deadlines and milestones to provide the House Bill 3100 modernization report in June of 2016.
Any questions? All right. It'll be our heavy lift to try and get you those resources you need to do what business you need to do it. That's not going to be inexpensive, I think.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
quick question. A little bit in jest. I'm wondering if Representative Greenlick is going to be on that advisory.
No, he is not. I assure you.
Dog it from afar.
He is not going to be. That's
I just want to make one comment.
Yes, please.
Committee members and audience participants, the CMS letter that was just handed to the committee is now up on OLIS and it is public.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do I have to reopen into informational meetings, or are we in an informational meeting?
We are in an informational, but it's the chair's pleasure.
Well, let me call the next agenda item, which is a physical therapy licensure compact presentation. Who's up for that?
You want me to read the names?
Yeah.
We have Leslie Adrian, James Hyder, Steve Allstott.
We're going to have plenty of time to deal with this. This is coming to us as a Senate committee, as a Senate bill, I believe. So if you would just briefly introduce it to us so we know what's coming, I'd appreciate that. Please introduce yourself when you begin.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, I am Leslie Adrian, Director of Professional Standards from the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about the Physical Therapy Licensure Compact. As the spouse of an Army officer, the Physical Therapy Licensure Compact is very important to me. As you may know, military spouse unemployment and underemployment is a problem faced by our military that affects both morale and retention. An initiative such as the Physical Therapy Licensure Compact directly impacts the ease of licensing and relocating for military spouses such as myself. So the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy partnered with the Council of State Governments, which is a nonpartisan organization that serves all three branches of state government. They have extensive experience in developing and implementing interstate compacts. So the Federation, a little bit about us, is that we're a member organization of physical therapy regulatory boards, including the Oregon Board of Physical Therapy, and our mission is public protection. So what is an interstate compact? Interstate compact, importantly, has legal status as both a contract and a law amongst the member states. So it's a simple, versatile, and proven tool. It's a contract between states, as I said. And really, most importantly, it retains state sovereignty over issues that really belong to the states. Oregon itself is a member of over 25 interstate compacts. So the purpose of the Physical Therapy Licensure Compact, it's designed to achieve the following objectives. First and foremost is to increase public access to physical therapy services. It's also to enhance the state's ability to protect the public's health and safety. It's to support military spouses of relocating military members and enhance the exchange of licensure, investigatory, and disciplinary information amongst member states. And this is extremely important with regard to public protection. The compact language needs to be adopted by states as written without changes in order to maintain that contractual obligation. So when we talk about getting the compact started, the compact, by the statutory language, will take 10 states in order to become enacted. So hopefully we will see 9 states that have enacted the language. A 10th state will then adopt the language, and this compact will be adopted and it will be begun. So the compact commission will then be stood up. This compact commission has the complete licensure and disciplinary database that it maintains. And all states that are members of the compact are members of the commission. I think that's extremely important for you to understand, that the commission is made up of state representation. It's not made up of federal representation. It's not made up of organizations such as the Federation or the Professional Association. It's the state members themselves. So what happens is that you have a therapist, a physical therapist, we'll call them Chris right now, and they live in a home state. So let's say that Oregon is their home state. What they'll do is they'll pay the fees. They'll become licensed in a home state. So as I said, Oregon. Let's say then they want to also be able to work in Washington. So what they would do is, Washington's also a member of the compact. They pay a fee to both the commission and to potentially the state. The state has the ability to set the fee that they feel is appropriate. And then that information goes to the compact commission. And then the compact commission will assure that Chris is eligible to participate in the licensure compact. Because basically, as we were saying, this is really a privilege to be able to have a compact privilege. It's not for every licensee. A licensee that potentially has had some disciplinary action against them or has not maintained a clean licensure record, this is not a person who would be eligible to participate in the compact. So the compact commission is also then going to remit any of the fees to statewide. So you start at your home state and you want to then you want to go to Washington, let's say it's remote state Y. So any of the fees that Washington is due that the therapist has already paid will then go to that state. And then they're also, most importantly, going to notify Washington that this therapist is coming. We heard this from our executive directors, our administrators, and our board members, and they said, you know, for this physical therapy licensure compact to work, I want to know who is in my state practicing. That's extremely important to me. Oops. So the other important thing was, well, what happens if this therapist messes up? What if they do something wrong when they're working in my state and I'm not the licensing state? What happens? Well, that home state, they have issued the license to that therapist. So basically the only action that that state can take is against the license. But the remote state can act against this compact privilege that the licensee has in their state, in that jurisdiction. But as I said, we think of this as a privilege more than a right. So basically, if there's any discipline against a licensee, either in the compact privilege states or the home state where they have their license, it's going to remove compact privileges in any state in which they currently hold them. And basically, it's going to remove that compact privilege until both of the following have occurred. 2 years have passed since the board took the final action, and any and all encumbrances have been removed. So if the person had done something that was so egregious that they had a suspension of their license or some type of restriction placed upon them for 5 years, well, then that person is not eligible to use the compact privilege for 5 years. And then you have party states. Party states are any state where the person has applied for a compact privilege, a person has a license, a person has applied for a license. All of these states that are members of the compact already become party states, and they can share disciplinary information much earlier than they can now in the current way things are done. So if Chris loses the compact privilege, say that in the state of Washington, they did something that the or to say the state of Oregon that they did something that the state didn't like. But when they go to look at the other state in Washington, Washington says, you know what, in our ideas, that's not so bad. And, well, Chris is able to go ahead and try and get a license in the state of Washington. Nothing precludes them from ever going through the licensure realm that they've been doing for years and years. So it's really important, again, that I just reiterate that the physical therapy licensure compact language, like the 25 plus other compacts that Oregon is a current member of, be adopted as written without edit, so it maintains the contractual obligation amongst the member states. Thank you for your time. At this point, I will allow Jim Heider now to present his information.
Very briefly, please.
Sure. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jim Heider. I'm the director of the Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board. The PT board in Oregon has always been a national leader in identifying and trying to break down barriers to licensure for interstate PTs trying to move. The board has discussed the compact. They've seen the language, and they are in favor and supportive of this compact as written.
Oh, that's brief. Appreciate that.
I'll try and be more brief. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Steve Allstott. I'm representing the Oregon Physical Therapy Association, and I just want to let you know that the Oregon Physical Therapy Association supports this compact. Again, just looking to remove barriers for patient care, enhancing public safety, and then realizing the modern mobile workforce that we have today is really important. Another issue is looking at this may enhance the use of telemedicine and telehealth, which is becoming more prominent. On another note, I'm a partner in a outpatient physical therapy company with four clinics in Oregon and four clinics in Washington. And as an employer, and knowing the barriers that exist, trying to fill positions in a timely manner and being able to treat the patients that come to your clinic, this would be a really helpful step for those businesses. And I think it would also help the licensees who are traveling throughout the country be able to come into another state and practice without unnecessary burdens, but also guaranteeing public safety. Thanks.
Great. Any questions?
Just
I do want to know, this is coming over as a Senate bill, and we'll have plenty of time to discuss it when it gets here from the Senate. Representative Hayden?
Oh, yeah, I was just curious.
Bueller?
Thank you, Chair Green. Like, does the physical therapy, do you have reciprocity with the other states now, or is this because you don't have reciprocity?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, we don't have true reciprocity. We call it endorsement. So if someone licensed in another state wants to come to Oregon and work, they have to go through the full licensure process, which includes a credentialing, transfer of scores, exam scores. So it's quite a lengthy process. So, no, we do not have true reciprocity at this time.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Is there anyone who is going to be speaking in opposition to the concept? And if so, why, if they're not here?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, at this point, we have not come across anyone who would have opposition with regards to the introducing the compact language.
Okay, thank you guys very much. I appreciate it. We'll hear from you again soon, I expect. Who we got next?
Presentation on the Unity Center for Behavioral Health. Mike Newcomb, Legacy Health. George Keepers, Oregon Health Science University. Susan Mullaney, Kaiser Permanente. And then last would be David Russell, Adventist Health.
Please introduce yourself when you start.
Well, thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Everett W. Newcomb III, the Chief Operating Officer for Legacy Health. I also go by Mike Newcomb, so the record is correct. I've had the opportunity to talk to several members of the committee previously about the Unity Center for Behavioral Health, and I think just to bring everybody up to speed, I'd just like to take a minute or two to kind of talk about the current condition and how we help people in crisis and with mental health conditions are handled today, and talk a little bit then about what the Unity Center is going to do. As you know, when somebody is in crisis today, they have very few options. They can call a crisis line if one is available. They may be able to go to a crisis center and get some counseling on an outpatient basis. What happens all too often is they're either encountered by the police, or they're taken by family members, or walk in themselves into an emergency room. And all too often, if they're encountered by police, they're taken to jail or an emergency room. Perhaps the worst place for a patient with mental health crisis is in jail. The second worst place, but certainly infinitely better than jail, is a regular emergency room. They're very well equipped to handle physical emergencies, but not very well equipped to handle mental health crises and emergencies in our regular emergency rooms. Our emergency rooms across the state of Oregon, quite frankly, are inundated with patients who are suffering from mental health conditions. Just today, as an example, in Legacy's ERs alone, we were holding 23 patients with mental health conditions in the ER waiting for placement and waiting for appropriate care that they would need in order to be able to recover from their problems.
Can you say that again?
In the Legacy Health ERs alone today, we're holding 23 patients waiting for placement either on an inpatient basis or for the appropriate outpatient care that they need.
Can I ask one quick question on that?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of those are children and adolescents?
There were eight today. There were eight children and adolescents who were being held waiting for placement in the Child and Adolescent Unit at Randall Children's Hospital. All of the Oregon inpatient units throughout the state operate at or very, very near 100% capacity all of the time, which is part of the problem. And it's compounded by the fact that many of those patients have been committed, need long-term care, and are waiting for placement in either this one of the state hospitals or another long-term outpatient facility. And consequently, they're held in our inpatient facilities for much longer than the acute inpatient facilities really should be holding those patients. So we've developed this Unity Center for Behavioral Health in Portland, and it's a collaboration between Legacy Health, OHSU, Adventist, and Kaiser. But I think even more importantly than that, it's a collaboration that's supported by three counties, the city of Portland, and many, many, many community outpatient resources who have all come together to develop this particular organization. It's a $50 million capital investment. About $10 million of that is the actual physical plant that's being donated by Legacy to this effort, and about $40 million in order to be able to renovate the facility and bring it up to a good standard for caring for patients. It will consist of 104 beds, inpatient beds. 82 of those will be for adults and 22 for child and adolescents. It'll also, though, beyond just having an inpatient capability, it will have a dedicated psychiatric emergency room staffed by a psychiatrist and mental health professionals 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We're projecting that we'll serve between 45 and 55 patients a day in our psychiatric ED. And Dr. Keepers will tell you in just a minute a little bit more about the model of care and how we propose to care for patients in that psychiatric ED, as well as in the inpatient side. There are two more components, though, that really make the Unity Center unique, one of which is a physical location for the community-based resources, be that the Cascadias or Central City Concerns or LifeWork Northwest, Trillium Family Services, whatever, and there are many, many, many of them, that have a physical location for representatives of their organization to be in this facility so that when patients are being seen there and then ready for discharge, either from the psychiatric ED or the inpatient facility, there'll be a warm handoff from that facility, so the patient will know which organization they're going to be seen by, the organization will know the patient, and they'll be able to connect from that standpoint. And then the fourth leg of the stool is a very robust peer support program. And peers in this instance are people who have been through a crisis themselves, have received additional training on how to intersect and interact with patients who are going through a crisis, and they'll then tie up one-on-one with these people so that when they're discharged, they'll connect with the patients on an outpatient basis, make sure that they've gotten the medications, if they're appropriate, if they're on a medication that they can take, that they're not having major problems with those, that they're getting resources that they need on an outpatient basis. And then very, very critically, and this has been a shortcoming of many of the other or a similar type of organizations around the country that have done something like this before, they'll make sure that that patient gets to that first appointment with that community resource. Because all too often, particularly with mental health problems, patients just don't get there, and consequently they don't get the care they need on the outpatient side. That appointment, which is very valuable, goes open and not filled, and it's a real problem. And then it turns into the revolving door of patients coming back to the psych ED, or in today's world the regular ED, and are seen again and again.
I'm sorry, a point.
Sure.
Who's going to do that coordination?
The peer support organization, the peers themselves, will be tied one-on-one with that patient when they're discharged. And in fact, they'll be in the Unity Center for Behavioral Health, so they'll be able to meet and work with that patient while they're still in the facility before they're discharged.
Can you explain what a peer support organization is?
Yes, and it's an organization of people who have been through a crisis themselves previously, have received some additional training on how to interact with patients who are going through a crisis, and then they will then be able to follow up. It's a support organization that, quite honestly, it's, I've been through this, I got through it, you can get through this too, and it really works. And I think George probably could talk, Dr. Keepers could talk a little bit more in more depth about what the peer really does provide to this, and I think he will in your comments in a minute. The organization will be operated as a department of Legacy Emanuel Medical Center. Most of the employees will be employees of Legacy, and there's a number of reasons that I've talked to Representative Greenlick about this before. It's because of a federal law called the IMD exclusion, the inpatient mental health disease exclusion. It is a federal law that quite honestly was instituted so that the states would be responsible for providing care for mental health patients rather than the federal government. And it basically states that you can't have a freestanding facility of greater than 16 beds and get paid by Medicaid for anyone between the ages of 18 and 64. So it will be operated under the department as a Department of Emanuel, which allows us then to quite legally get around this IMD exclusion. The physicians, however, will be employed, the vast majority of them will be employed by OHSU, have a faculty appointment at OHSU, and OHSU will be moving their adult inpatient psychiatry residency to the Unity Center, as well as their fellowship for child and adolescent care. And it'll also serve then as a training site for emergency department residents, medical students, nurse practitioners, mental health nurse practitioners, and many other mental health staff. And I think it will help then to grow this very, very scarce resource in Oregon, which we really, really desperately need. And with that, I'll tell you a little bit more about where we are today and the future. But I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Keepers to talk a little bit about the care model.
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Dr. George Keepers. I'm the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at OHSU. I want to speak particularly about the psychiatric emergency service that we are developing as part of this facility. It is based on models that go considerably back in time. People began talking about these kind of facilities more than a quarter of a century ago, and they have been implemented at a number of other places. We have particularly modeled this one after the program at Alameda in California, but have surveyed other facilities throughout the country. The program that we are building will be superior to those programs. It will be superior in terms of its physical facility, which will be much nicer than the program at Alameda. It will be superior in terms of its staffing as well. We intend to staff this facility 24/7 with psychiatrists and nurse practitioners. There will be peers in the facility, trained peers who will provide services in the facility and to patients as they become outpatients and linked with the community mental health center. As Dr. Newcomb mentioned, we will also have in the facility representatives from the major mental health centers throughout the city, Cascadia and LifeWorks and others, who will assist us in moving people from the facility to outpatient care. The model in the emergency facility itself is one of brief treatment. So this is not a place like would be the case in an emergency room where individuals are simply put in a room and they wait for psychiatric hospitalization. Instead, they're going to be actively treated and supported while they are there. We will limit the time that they are there in the emergency facility to about 23 hours. We expect that about 70% of the people who are treated there will be able to be discharged from the facility to ambulatory care and will not need hospitalization. If you talk to any of our psychiatrists on inpatient units throughout the city and in emergency rooms, you would find that because we lack such facilities now, that a number of the hospitalizations that we have to make are not truly needed if treatment could be provided. And so that is our intent with this. I believe the evidence is that we will succeed with it. And I will stop there, answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you.
I have one.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Is this going to increase the number of hospital beds that are available for patients that are experiencing something psychiatric in the city?
It will, mainly because of the model that we're using. The total number of beds is about the same as we have currently today. The Unity Center will be a consolidation of the current inpatient facilities at Legacy, OHSU, and Adventist. But today, we're seeing between 25 and 35% of the patients who are admitted to the inpatient unit are coming in for short stays of 48, 72 hours. As Dr. Keepers just said, by being able to treat and discharge back to the community up to 75% of the patients today and having to admit then a much smaller number of patients into the inpatient side, we'll be able to leverage those beds much better than we're able to do today. So it's about the same number of beds, but if it were under today's model, it would be the equivalent of about 150 beds.
Can I ask one follow-up question? So how is it you're going to be able to do that? You probably explained this, and I'm sorry if I didn't catch it. Because you're saying basically you're not going to keep them as long, if what I understood you correctly. So how is that going to be? Like, what's going to be different from your model than, say, what I currently experience where I go to an ER? Is it just I won't have to wait? Is that the main thing?
No. So if you go to an ER right now and you're in need of psychiatric hospitalization, the chances are you'll be kept in the emergency room and not treated.
I agree with that.
Yeah. So you will wait in the emergency room for a period of time. An emergency room stay is not really good for a psychiatric crisis.
I agree with that, too.
So instead, what we will do in this facility is that we will provide immediate evaluation and immediate treatment, as well as immediate social supports to individuals. And we will have the means to hook them up with available ambulatory care. So many of them will not actually need to come into the hospital as a result of that.
Okay.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. So I know you had an issue before with a code that needed to be activated so that you could be reimbursed for more than just a typical emergency room that averages 4 hours. I assume that's been taken care of. The piece that I'm really interested in is how the care coordination piece is going to be reimbursed. We had a bill last year that we ended up not moving forward on, but we want to continue to do work that would ask healthcare coverage carriers to cover that transition period. Like, who does the care coordination when somebody's assigned, you know, somebody, say, Central City Concern, a week later? You say you have those people right there making a personal connection and then making sure they show up. I think the concern that I've had is if you don't make sure that you have somebody who's making sure that coordination happens and then covering it, that the Central City Concern, well, if they don't show up, we don't get reimbursed. So they weren't calling to make sure that somebody came. So there's a gap there that looks like you've solved, and I'm curious how you solved it, because I want to make sure that we can do that in all the regions around the state that aren't lucky enough to have a Unity.
So, and that's a great question. You know, right now the peer support organization that will do some of this coordination. It's just going to be part of the budget, if you will, of the Unity Center. And the Unity Center is being financially supported by the four organizations, Legacy, OHSU, Adventist, and Kaiser. So that will be part of our budget, is to provide that peer support. The support on the part of the Cascadias, as an example, it's very much in their best interest to have that appointment filled rather than open and not utilized, because then they do get reimbursed for it, and obviously the patient gets much better care. So there will be a coordination then between the peer and that outside organization to try to keep track with this, with these patients. Obviously, this doesn't solve all the problems of the world. It doesn't solve housing issues, and that's a big issue, obviously, for patients who are homeless. You know, it's very difficult to find them, locate them, and follow up with them on the outpatient side. But that's part of what we're trying to accomplish with, at least through this peer organization, and then through better coordination with the community resources. You know,
we have about 5 minutes
more. Yes, sir.
Do you want to update us on where you are right now?
I will, and then I'd like to pass the microphone off to our representatives from Kaiser and Adventist. So very, very quickly, just to tell you where we are today, we are in the schematic design phase for the facility. Matter of fact, we're virtually finished with it. We have a couple little tweaks in the psychiatric emergency area yet to do, but we're virtually done with the schematic design part of the architectural design. We have an RFP that we put out for the general contractor who's going to build this. We've had four responses, and we'll be letting that contract in within the next 2 weeks. We have over 20 work groups people who are getting together to figure out the nitty-gritty details of how this is really going to work. And we've been very, very heartened by the fact that it's been heavily supported by all of these organizations, not just the four hospital organizations, but by the community organizations, the counties, the police, the firefighters, EMS, have all been part of their appropriate work groups, covering such things as the design, care model, finance, transportation, EMS coordination, and then very, very critically, we have a very robust transitions of care work group that are really trying to develop this model of how we're going to develop those transitions and make this happen. Community Advisory Council, we're in the process of hiring the vice president who's going to lead the Unity Center, and we intend to have that person on board right around the first of the year. Dr. Keepers was saying as we were waiting earlier that we're in the process right now of interviewing for the chief medical officer and getting very close, I believe, to hiring that individual as well. This Thursday, we have, rather than a groundbreaking, since it's a renovation, we're having a wall bashing. So we'll be conducting that on Thursday and looking forward to that, to get that going. And we're on track to open the facility in late November, early December of 2016, which has been our target date all along. So with that, I'd just like to pass this off, if I could, please.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. I'm Susan Mullaney. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Kaiser Permanente Northwest. And I'll just add a few comments and keep it brief. The reason why we chose to participate in this new venture is because we felt that this was one of the most innovative steps forward happening, not just in the state, but across the country. And I really want to thank Mike for his leadership in getting us to this point. He kept all of us together on this. And while technically we're not adding beds to the community, it's exactly what Mike described, as it's a new model that will help keep people out of an inpatient psychiatric facility and get the care that they need in a much more effective and quicker way. So we're responsible for over 500,000 people, and we have a lot of our members who need to access acute psychiatric care. We also run a hospital system, so I experienced what Mike described earlier with having people who are having a psychiatric emergency in our EDs for days on end. Nobody wants that to happen. And this, while this doesn't solve everything, it's going to solve a lot of that. And so that's why we came to the table as a key partner in this venture, and we plan on contributing all of the internal expertise that we have. We feel that this is a linchpin in our overhaul of mental health services within our own system. And I'm also confident that we're going to learn a lot as we go through this. and link arms in ways that we haven't before with the community to really address some of the fundamental needs that exist. So we're proud to be a part of it. I think that our members are really going to get top-notch care, and we're here to support the community that needs to access that facility as well. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Yeah.
Okay.
One more presenter.
Right.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and committee members. My name is David Russell. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Adventist Health, Adventist Medical Center in Portland. And we appreciate the time that you've given us to come and share with you. I would just say that the Adventist Health team is very excited to be a part of this venture. And we operate one of the largest behavioral health, inpatient behavioral health care programs in the metro area, and have had a long-term commitment to serving behavioral health patients in our community. The challenges that we've faced have, and I think you're all very aware of, the economic challenges that we encounter, and I think that's one of the very positive parts of this program is that the care delivery model is new, and it will allow us to offer care to the community not only in an improved fashion from a patient care perspective, but also in a more long-term sustainable financial model. And so we're just pleased that the four organizations have been able to come together and really put together something that we truly believe will be an example, really, not only to across our state, but across the nation of a much better way to provide care.
Quick question.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I just have a quick question. I understand the four entities working together and really see a great value. My question is, how do you interact with the community as far as public safety, involuntary, like police officer, will they be able to come directly there and have communication come directly there rather than to another emergency room? Or how does that, how do family members maybe that are in crisis, not really admit, but come to your facility? How does that work?
Thank you for that. That's an excellent question, Representative Hayden. We will see anybody, no matter how they get there. Part of the reason I think that the city of Portland and frankly the counties are so excited about this project is that it really helps them do two things. Number one, if a police officer or a sheriff's deputy encounters somebody who is in apparent mental health crisis. Under today's model, basically what they do is they put them in the car in handcuffs and they either take them to jail or an emergency room. Under this model, what we're trying to do is, and this required a rule change, and I would like to acknowledge the help that the Oregon Health Authority has provided in being able to modify some of the rules to allow this to happen. But the police officer, on encountering someone like that, will call EMS. EMS will come and evaluate the patient under a protocol that's been developed to determine whether a medical condition exists or not that might need to go to a regular emergency room. And barring that, EMS will then do the transfer to the Unity Center. Patients can come in, they can walk in, they can be brought in by family members, brought in by friends. It doesn't really matter how they get there. But by being able to take the police out of the middle, it really helps to, again, to decriminalize mental health problems. I mean, this is a disease like any other disease. It's not a crime. Secondly, it gets police officers back on the street doing what police officers need to do, and that doesn't include transporting patients to hospitals. So we think this is a little bit, again, a little bit better model than we've seen elsewhere.
But you won't have lockup facilities.
We won't have lockup as in jail facilities. The intent is Dr. Actually, let me ask you.
So the facility is intended to minimize the need for any kind of seclusion or restraint. We do have facilities in case we would need to, on the inpatient units particularly. We have designed it so and staffed it so that will largely be prevented, however.
Representative Lagman.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. So my question has to do with the longer term, and I commend you for getting together and doing this. I think it makes great sense. But so is there a shared risk? So if everything doesn't work exactly in the timing, there's obviously some financial risk. And so is that shared amongst the partners? How does that work?
Yes, the partners are sharing this. Like I said, we share the profit and loss, Reed loss. This is going to continue. You know, mental health care is one of those things that loses money for many organizations, hospitals not the least of which, and we'll continue to lose money on this. I think by coming together, though, we'll be able to provide better care, more economically, and indeed, we clearly think this is a better model that will produce better outcomes. So we've done our business planning, we've done our pro formas, we have an idea of where we think this is going to go. Quite frankly, I think all four partners, though, and don't want to speak for the others, but I'm pretty sure we're in this for the long haul. Okay. And if this should happen not to quite pencil out as is planned, I think we're just going to have to address that. I think this, quite honestly, is so clearly the right thing to do that I think we're all pretty much committed to it.
Thank you for your efforts. It seems like a great strategy.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being brief. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to have just a very brief introduction to the question of the Cadillac tax that's facing us. Thought it might be useful to raise it with the committee so we know what we're probably going to be looking at pretty soon on this question of the Cadillac tax. And I'm going to invite, who do we have? Tom Holt and Bethany Bocci.
Unity.
Yeah, it's great.
Bocce.
It's exciting.
Yep. Bocce. Yeah. Well, that's a no, not an A. Thank you very much for coming.
Glad to, sir. I think there's a short deck in your OS. Is it here?
We didn't upload it for a PowerPoint. You mean the one-pager?
That PowerPoint. Okay.
You gave us last month?
Yeah. It's okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions, and with me is Bethany Bocci from Stoll Reeves. Our objective here today is really to just provide you with an overview and 30,000-foot briefing on an issue that, while largely federal, may have some significant effects on the Oregon insurance market and insurance markets everywhere, and benefit design that may then have secondary effects of percolating to things that end up coming in front of this this body. So just a little bit about what it is, briefly. It's an excise tax on particularly rich health insurance benefits. It's a 40% tax on the value of benefits at an initial level starting in 2018 that are worth more than $10,200 for an individual or $27,500
That's per year, I assume.
Per year for a family. And all pre-tax, at a simplified level, there's some nuances and rules that we're all waiting on, but at a simplified level, one way to think of it is that essentially all pre-tax dollars count toward the thresholds, and after-tax dollars do not count. So the premium that my share of out-of-pocket premium counts, what my employer chips in counts, but the dollars that I spend out-of-pocket for, say, a doctor's visit or at the pharmacy, those don't count. Those are after-tax dollars. Wellness program dollars count. Dollars that are contributed to a health savings account or a flexible spending account, something many people use to manage the expected expenses, those count. So let me give you one example of how this could actually be assessed. Let's say an employer buys a $10,000 plan for an individual employee. And the employee has some extra dollars laying around and chips in another, it's more than a chip, $4,200 to an HSA. Well, now it's over the threshold And it's over the threshold by about $4,000. So there's going to be a $1,600 tax because, not because the basic benefit is over the threshold, but the benefit combined with the health savings account contribution throws it over the threshold.
The 40% is only on the amount over the
threshold. Only on the amount over. So in this simplified example, you know, there's a $1,600 tax. Who's going to pay it?
Pay it.
Yet to be determined by IRS rules. Some people think, well, the employer's going to pay it. Some people say, oh, somehow the carrier will pay it, in which case it's going to show up in premium. And some would say, yeah, the individual's going to be on the hook to pay that. We don't know the answer to that yet, but that's at a high level how it's going to work. There is another wrinkle, though, in that the thresholds are not adjusted for healthcare inflation, but regular CPI. And I think we all know in this committee, at least, that healthcare runs a lot further ahead of than CPI does.
Not in Oregon. We have healthcare transfer.
In the commercial market, we're going to have that too.
So for those of you who may have had the joy of finding a line on your tax return of an alternative minimum tax, either a little or maybe a lot, to pay, it's going to be a lot like that over time, in that plans that people may not have left unchanged, plans that people may not have thought of as being particularly rich, will eventually become subject to the tax. So what's that practically mean in terms of how is it going to affect people's benefits? Well, because health savings account and flexible savings account contributions are going to be subject to the tax, and employers don't necessarily have an ability to control how much an employee puts into those kind of accounts, it's going to tend to discourage having those accounts attached to a health benefit. It's going to tend to discourage spending pre-tax dollars on things like wellness programs or other things that aren't necessarily actually insurance, but they relate to health expenses. They're all kind of in this. It's going to tend to discourage because it will encourage employers to move toward higher deductibles to lower their costs, puts more of the after-tax dollar in the expense in the employee's burden. We know from 20 years of experience now with high deductible arrangements that if it goes too far, you end up tending to discourage people using services that they should be getting. And that's kind of at the margins. If people don't get services that they should be getting, well, when they do finally get services, their problems tend to be more complex and more costly. It will tend to encourage, on the other hand, more adoption of, well, you can pick your terms. Some people call them narrow networks. We prefer high performance networks, but network products where you're making a trade of more limited choice of providers in exchange for a much lower cost. So to get under those thresholds, you know, you may see some of that. Now, is all that going to happen every time? Well, no, because at least preliminarily, if you've seen one employer plan and how this may apply, you've kind of seen one. Lots of considerations go into how you might react to this, but as a general rule, those are some of the things that we'll see. So other than that, it has all sorts of wonderful things to recommend it. Why did they do this? Well, one theory is, and the math bears this out, that for a higher income worker, a tax deduction or non-taxable status, that has more benefit. And so it's trying to even out the impact of tax deductibility of health benefits from higher income to lower income employees. Another theory is that rich plans tend to encourage a bit of medical waste, because there's not an incentive to not use it. And then the people who actually wrote this piece of the ACA say, well, it was one way of getting at making high-value health benefits equivalent to removing the tax deductibility altogether. It's a very convoluted and back-end way of getting to the same place in economic terms. Who's affected by this? Mainly larger employers who tend to have richer benefits. It's in percentage terms a little less than a fifth of all employers by some recent analyses, but about 4 in 10 large employers. So generally those larger employers are at risk of this much more than small employers.
Health and welfare trusts might be.
Yeah. So your health and welfare labor trusts, which tend to have generous benefits, large employers that tend to have generous benefits, government employee plans, whether it's federal, state, or local governments, they all tend, all three of those have in common, they tend to be relatively richer benefits versus other types of employers. And again, over time, more and more people. It's essentially not much of a small group product issue. Small group is an area that's extremely price sensitive, and employers are just trying to get some kind of coverage in place, tend not to buy.
How will flexible accounts play into this?
Flexible spending accounts?
Yeah, where people can put their money into health care, they can put it into home care, child care.
Mr. Chair, the short answer is that the dollars that go into those kind of accounts, whether they're contributed by the employer or the employee, are going to count toward the taxable threshold.
So even if it's not used for health care?
Generally, I think if it's used for health care,
sometimes you can use the money on child care or you can buy.
Right. You have to choose one or the other.
Right. The dependent care benefits doesn't factor into this at all. So it's just the piece of your flexible spending account that you put aside for medical. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Bethany
Yes,
Bocci.
Please go ahead. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bethany Bocci, a partner with the firm of Stoll Reeves, and I practice in the employee benefits area and counsel primarily large employers, some smaller employers, on compliance with this act and other regulatory requirements that apply to health and welfare plans and retirement plans.
You're gonna say something?
No, I just was really here more to answer questions as they came up. Okay. I don't have a presentation.
I'm just rattling somebody to help them out.
The big kind of political question around this is, will Congress modify this in some way? There's been a lot of headlines the last few months about this, and there's a kind of fascinating coalition. You have on the one hand, the AFL-CIO has made this a priority, and so has the Chamber of Commerce. And you have everybody amongst the many people running for president, everyone from Bernie Sanders to Ted Cruz are pounding on the Cadillac tax. At this point in time, there's about 80 billion reasons why Congress won't take an action right away, in that the Cadillac tax is a key piece of funding important aspects of the Affordable Care Act. And there's no obvious pay-for solution. So it's a source of exchange subsidies. So, question?
Representative Nose?
Finally, Mr. Chair, thank you. We have a topic I actually know something about.
A rarity.
So it is a rarity. Because I work for a union, we're wrestling with this, right? And I prefer the term good benefits or good coverage as opposed to rich or generous.
There you go. I'll take that.
So here's what I wonder about. I understand about the financing piece that this is sort of going to help with regard to the Affordable Health Care Act. But if really all we do is figure out how to avoid paying it, it's not really going to provide the financing that's envisioned. Because so far, every discussion I've been in as a union representative with large employers who want to, have good insurance to be able to attract people to work for them, it's really about how do we just avoid paying it. They're not going to pay it, or they're going to make us pay it, right, us the workers, and we're figuring out how to, modify our benefits. Like, I suspect a quick, easy way that people will deal with it is we won't have flexible spending accounts. We'll stop doing that.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairperson, if I could answer that, the Congressional Budget Office and their forecast for where the $87 billion is projected to come from, three-quarters of that is anticipated to come from additional payroll taxes because of employers shifting, paying people more, and giving less generous benefits. So the bulk of the revenue isn't anticipated to come from the tax. It's anticipated to come from additional payroll taxes.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, a platinum plan on the exchange fall into that?
Probably. Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I suppose it's possible, but I don't know the exact value of a platinum plan, so I don't know.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I would argue it would come close because the platinum plan would be the only plan that a lot of union members would recognize as actually being good coverage. I mean, so it'll come close. And so just about every union trust is dealing with this situation in some form or another. So it'll come close.
Representative Bueller and then Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
Briefly, please.
Either of you, do you have an estimate of the percentage of government employees in the state of Oregon who have Cadillac tax plans? Have Cadillac health plans?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I don't know. That would be a great question for LFO, perhaps, but I would say in general, as we've looked in our business, we serve a lot of government employee groups, and much more often than not, the expectation is that their benefits as they stand today would be over the threshold or very, very close to it.
Perhaps they should restructure away from it. We'll explore that more as we go forward.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think in terms of just to kind of get to what are the implications that this body should be kind of caring about, I would say in general this is one of those things of watchful waiting in the sense that so much of this is out of the state's control and depends on decisions that the IRS makes in its coming rulemaking, what Congress may or may not do at the margins. But we think that the essential narrative, barring, this unusual coalition actually pushing, a repeal through in an election year when Congress works a short year, that basic story is going to remain the same. And there are potential, I underscore potential because there are so many unknowns yet in the details of the rules. There are potential impacts on PEB, on OEB, on every local government's budget, which many of those indirectly touch, the state budget in small and large ways. So I don't have a particular solution to offer you, but I thought it was important to just kind of bring this to your attention as something to be watching carefully and thinking about and probably asking some questions of the people who supply you all with numbers to make sure that everybody is at least eyes wide open as we head toward 2018.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Basically, I had the same question. My understanding is that for many single state employees now, or single coverage state employees now, we're paying, or the state's paying, or their entity, county, whatever it is, paying about $14,000, and probably by the time this comes, we might be paying $16,000. So my question was actually going to be to Stoll Reeves. Have you looked at that on a state level, or have any reason to have researched that at all and see what that cost burden will be?
Yeah,
and I suspect you may have.
Well, Chairman Greenlick and Representative Hayden, we haven't looked at it necessarily for government employees because we don't work a lot with government employees, but there was a survey out in late August from the Congressional Research Service where they indicated 6.7 of employer-sponsored single premium plans in Oregon were expected to exceed the Cadillac tax threshold, and that's just based on the insurance medical piece alone, not the spending accounts or the other things that get added in, and 5% on the family coverage level. And you mentioned those numbers for Oregon. To the extent those individuals...
That's for everyone or just...
For Oregon.
Private.
It didn't distinguish. I think it was for everyone. But union employees, to the extent those government employees are unionized, you just look, all union employees, no matter what the coverage, get the higher limit of $27,500. So those 14 or 16 folks, if they were in a union, they're not going to be triggering the tax right away. So there is a little relief for union members.
Okay, I'm afraid we need to move on. We're going to have lots of time to discuss this. I really appreciate you.
Can you clarify that last point? Neither one of us understood that.
So there are two thresholds for where the tax is triggered. It depends on whether you have employee-only coverage or employee plus, like not single coverage. And so if for employee-only, that threshold is set by statute at $10,200 for the 2018 plan year. And for employee plus, so it doesn't matter how many families currently are in addition to the employee, that threshold's $27,500 mm-hmm. before you trigger the tax. But there's a special provision that for union employees who are part of a multi-employer plan, you don't look at that lower single employee threshold. That's not applicable. You only look at the $27,500 threshold.
A multi-employer plan.
Right, a multi-employer
plan. That
wouldn't
be state employees.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know what if the state has a multi-employer plan or not. I don't know what OPEB or PEBS
considered. We only have one employer called
okay.
C.
So.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks. We'll hear more, I guarantee you guys, before we're done.
I'm sure we will.
Let me call now. We're going to hear a little bit about the result of the Oregon Health Equity Alliance report. Very briefly.
Yeah, we're going to have to really cut it short.
Mr. Moreno?
Do you want me to get three of them up here?
You can get three of them up there.
Alberto Moreno, Janet Bauer, okay. Reverend Joe Enlett. And then on deck will be Jeremy Rigsby and Linda Roman.
And we have a total of 14 minutes or something?
Well, we're behind schedule.
I know where we are. I'm just saying. But I know where I'm going to get 20 minutes at the end. So.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, distinguished members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and co-chair of the Oregon Health Equity Alliance. We are here because lack of health care coverage persists. This basic right is a foundation toward economic mobility for thousands of Oregonians and their families. Our organization's interest and responsibility are for the concerns of communities of color, immigrants, and refugees, whose population has grown to over 750,000 in Oregon. We have been working to address historic and persistent health inequities facing our working families, elders, and children. We are consistently engaged in state-level public policy because of two interconnected beliefs. One, that we all pay the price for poor health, with study after study underscoring the high cost to the system, the undermining of our economy, and the financial and emotional toll on families and small businesses, and the pain, certainly, and suffering experienced by the most vulnerable amongst us. Two, access to care is the cornerstone of well-being for working families, and affordable insurance is critical to the future prosperity of all 36 Oregon counties. The Oregon Health Equity Alliance and dozens of organizational partners present to you our report, Mend the Gap, Why Full Coverage Makes Sense for Oregon. The Oregon Health Equity Mend the Gap report details the gaps in coverage and the disproportionate impacts on rural Oregonians, communities of color, immigrants, women, LGBTQ communities, people with chronic conditions, and low-wage working families. The report recognizes that while having health insurance is no guarantee of actually receiving care, it is certainly a primary driver of good health outcomes. And despite strides in health reform, 383,000 Oregonians, nearly 1 in 10 in our great state, remain uninsured. Urgent work is needed to ensure good health for Oregon's changing demographics. State leaders have pragmatic policy options to mend the gaps and ensure every Oregonian in every county has affordable access to health care. Key findings of the report include the fact that large swaths of rural Oregon suffer from poor access to health services. that 18% of communities of color lack health insurance. That's in comparison to 8% of whites. That low-income Oregonians who are not eligible for Medicaid are more than twice as likely as Oregonians with higher incomes to be uninsured. LGBTQ adults are uninsured at a rate of 23%, and it is remarkable that a recent study found that 22% of transgender Oregonians reported being refused medical care. Let me say they were refused medical care that they were otherwise entitled to. Immigrants, many of whom live in mixed-status families where some members are U.S. citizens, face a myriad of exclusions, and my colleagues here will discuss those in detail. We know that the uninsured and the underinsured are more likely to end up in emergency rooms and hospitalized for preventable illnesses, adding cost to the healthcare system and state budget. The impacts also ripple out to the economy when illness means children attain lower educational levels and workers are less productive in our great state. We would suggest that Oregon's economic future depends on the health of everyone. Affordable, comprehensive health care coverage makes sense for families and for the state. When families have affordable, comprehensive health care coverage, they are able to devote more of their resources to meeting other important needs. Having to spend less on health care helps families get ahead. In conclusion, providing affordable, comprehensive coverage reflects and affirms our state's values that every person and every family in Oregon matters. Thank you for your time today.
Can I take that? Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Our organization participated on the research team to formulate the Mend the Gap report. Mr. Moreno said, the report that identifies the work still to be done in health reform in Oregon. We provided research assistance to partners who contributed sections of the report, and we checked the report's facts. We also contributed analysis of the most recent data from the American Community Survey on health insurance in Oregon. That was for 2014 and was released a couple months ago. Unsurprisingly, we found that Oregon has made tremendous progress in health coverage as compared to the previous year, and we found a significant gap remained. Specifically, almost 1 in 10 Oregonians still lack coverage. That's more than 380,000 individuals. So, I should also note that these survey findings from the American Community Survey differ somewhat from estimates of the uninsured in Oregon recently arrived at by the OHSU, and their estimates are based on administrative data primarily. So as we know, getting Oregonians insured is job number one in health insurance, in health reform. So it's important to know who are the uninsured. And the American Community Survey is by far the best tool for answering that question. And as Mr. Moreno has said, we have found that Oregonians of color are more than twice as likely as non-Hispanic whites to be uninsured. Further, low-wage workers are at risk, specifically individuals below 200% of the federal poverty level who aren't eligible for Medicaid are uninsured at twice the rate of individuals who have higher incomes. Other sources of information helped us understand the causes of the gap. Our report explains that immigrants authorized to live and work in this country under the Compact of Free Association tend to be uninsured, as do other legal immigrants. Undocumented children and adults also comprise individuals in this group. Our report went further to highlight the difficulties in getting care for some Oregonians who do have insurance. We note in the report that barriers to care exist for women, specifically reproductive health care, transgender individuals, rural residents, people with chronic conditions, a group that includes older working age Oregonians not eligible for Medicare, and that dental care access is problematic for many adults who purchase coverage in Oregon's marketplace. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to introduce you to this report, and we look forward to working with you on solutions. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Roman. I'm the Director of Health Policy for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and the Oregon Health Equity Alliance. Thank you for the time today. Oregon has certainly been a national leader in being an innovator and an implementer for health expansion. While we have made some great strides, many Oregonians still are left behind. We are here today because of those Oregonians. Providing affordable and comprehensive coverage reflects our state values. Every person and every family in Oregon matters. Mend the Gap outlines 10 policy recommendations, several of which have been carefully maturing through legislative work groups and broad stakeholder engagement with bipartisan support. We have worked with at the local level with the development of CCOs and are consistently working with health industry partners and impacted community members. Here are the 6 recommendations. The first one is to adopt a basic health plan in Oregon. A basic health plan could reach many Oregonians who currently are uninsured. Basic health would offer more affordable coverage to low-income Oregonians who make too much to qualify for the Oregon health plan. That's 138% to 200%. Basic health plan could also offer affordable coverage for legal permanent residents and COFA individuals. These are folks who are legally residing here in Oregon who have low incomes and would otherwise be covered by the Oregon health plan but are barred by federal law. Simply, this is about boosting access to health services for cash-strapped households by reducing costly preventable illnesses and addressing health disparities. Later today, the Basic Health Stakeholder Group will provide some recommendations. The second one is to establish a premium assistance program. Mr. Inlet later will also share more detail what that is for COFA Oregonians. The third recommendation is about children. We recommend to extend an Oregon Health Plan-like program for all kids. Currently, there's about 17,600 children who are categorically ineligible for the Oregon's Medicaid program. We believe that regular health care access to quality care does mean needless suffering and a lifetime of poor health outcomes and increased mortality. The next 3 recommendations are about service delivery for communities that have high unmet health care needs that result in preventable hospitalization, mortality, and low birth weight. The fourth one is to strengthen benefits and lower costs for reproductive health services. The fifth one is to remove the administrative barriers that result in the denial of services for transgender people. The sixth one is residents in rural Oregon often have trouble finding a primary care provider within reasonable distance, and a hospital and specialist may be hours away. For many Oregonians in this situation, they have to wait months in order to get seen. We recommend to adopt a multi-pronged plan to improve rural health care access. We believe these recommendations will ultimately help Oregon realize its economic potential and achieve health reform goals for every person and every family in Oregon. I'm happy and able to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we'll move forward because the next 2 items also deal with this issue. I thank you very much for that report. I recommend everybody read it carefully, and it's available for all. We have a discussion on COFA now.
No, we've got 2 more here. This is Reverend Joe Enlett, right?
Two more on this?
Yeah, and Jeremiah.
I'm afraid we're out of time, so if you would just take a moment, please take very brief.
Okay.
We want to hear about COFA, and we want to hear about basic health plan, which relate to both of this, but please let's go for it.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of committee, thank you for
allowing us to speak. I'll just be very brief right now. I am Joe Enlett. I come from the island of Chuuk in the Federated States of Micronesia. So we are part of the COFA countries. I'm just here in support of the Mend the Gap report, as well as the report that's coming up next. The COFA report from the DCBS office. Basically, I'm here to say that along with legal permanent residents who face the five-year bar and other immigrant communities, COFA Islanders are excluded from coverage and are left with little to no options. Many of us face a lot of health issues. I am a pastor in the community, and I perform way too many funerals for our community members who have no access to any kind of health service because we are barred from Medicaid categorically. And even though we do qualify for APTC or tax credits under the exchange, that's very unaffordable still for our community members, and that is why it's very exciting for us to see that Oregon has been a leader in trying to address this issue. And last session, we thank you for passing HB 2522 last session, which is recommending or providing recommendations through the work group with DCBS to see how we can address this problem. And so we thank you for that, and hopefully we can continue to move forward and work to come up with a plan and really implement this plan to address issues for community members like COFA residents. Thank you.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Jeremiah Rigsby. I'm the Senior Manager for State and Federal Regulatory Affairs at CARE Oregon. As many of you know, we wholly own Columbia Pacific Coordinated Care Organization in the northwest portion of the state, Jackson Care Connect down south, and we're a big part of HealthShare. We have about 149,000 lives within HealthShare, and those are all OHP lives through the CCOs. We surveyed about 130,000 of our adult population, about 25% of them are from communities of color, and about 11% of our adult population, we have no idea what race or ethnicity they are. We're still working on getting accurate data in to figure out who is from a community of color and what services they need. But that's exciting because we're also starting to see some of the disparities between the different races regarding the healthcare that they use and what type of problems there are. We're in complete support of the Mend the Gap report because I think it shines a light on a lot of the differences and a lot of the disparities that we're starting to see within this population. I think it fits right within the wheelhouse of what CCOs are supposed to accomplish when it comes to innovation and when it comes to addressing disparities that have not been addressed yet. And as CARE Oregon, being a member of a number of CCOs, I think we have an interest in addressing those disparities as we're serving a lot of this population.
Thank you very much. Thank you both very much. We have two more topics. We were told we needed 5 minutes to talk about COFA.
Okay.
I'm not sure how we're supposed to have four.
We're going to, Representative Olson is out here, and he's bringing up Lloyd and David. Representative Olson said he is only going to take 30 seconds.
Come on. Come on.
Thank you, Representative G.
You can always, you can get 30 seconds of our committee anytime you want.
O-N-G.
Lloyd, you want to join us?
Yes. And then we'll bring Pat up, Mr. Allen, when he comes back into the room.
Okay. Let's go.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I am the state representative from the Albany area. Just want to take just a quick brief moment here. Thank you very much. Earlier last session, moving House Bill 2522 down to the subcommittee, and because that was an opportunity for us to really have a good evaluation of it. From there, we did move it forward through this building and then had DCBS to take a look at it. I think if you have not had a chance to read their findings and the report, which is pretty, I got to tell you, I'm pretty excited with what the matches that they came up with. And I'm not going to share that with you, but I'll leave that up to Lloyd and David here or to Mr. Allen, too. But I just want to say thank you, and I'll leave it at that.
You're pushing on it.
Thank you. I'm Lloyd Hinion.
I'm the board member of the CAN, and I just wanted to very briefly say that what a pleasure it was working with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. They took in all of the concerns and issues that the Stakeholders and Advisory Committee had, and I think because of that, we now have a very actionable report that can translate into a very good bill. And just on the benefit side, the federal government will be contributing $9 for every state dollar of state dollars.
I'm not sure that was on
my mind. Well, right.
That's good. That's economic development. $9 back from Washington.
Thank you. That's exactly right, the way I'm seeing it. Oregon will benefit, but the big winners will be the COFA group, who have not had access to health care. And rather than just doing crisis intervention, they'll actually get some help up front, which should help them a lot. And they're very excited about these prospects, and they're quite a deserving group. Thank you very much.
Representative Kulik, members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity. My name is David Anatok, the president for the Oregon Marshallese community and also a board member of the COFA Alliance National Network. And as mentioned, it was definitely a privilege to work with DCPS on this report coming up. And most of what's been said is what was in my heart to share today. I'm just really glad that we're here and want to thank you. And thank you, Representative Olson, for willing to help us carrying a bill for this next session.
Great. Thank you very much.
What's the name of that?
Mr. Allen?
Is the report in our materials?
Pardon me?
The report you're referring to in our materials?
I think.
I'm sorry?
Is the report they're referring to in our
committee? Yes, coming up with it should be on the list.
It's here. I think it's this one here. The COFA Pat Allen report.
Right. The COFA Pat
Mr. Allen, will you join us, please?
Right there. Okay, got it. Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Greenlich, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm joined today by Chicky Flowers, who is one of the program people with the Health Insurance Marketplace, who worked extensively, and you can tell from some of the comments, I think did some outstanding work with these stakeholders to complete the report. I think we emailed you each individually the report about a week ago, and it's up on OLIS now. The bottom line, couple of pieces. You've heard the 9-to-1 leverage that's available. In terms of federal funding, there's a lot of detail in the report, and we can answer questions for you if you'd like. The bottom line number is that the cost of a program like this that would provide Medicaid-like benefits to COFA members would be something on the order of about $1 to $1.8 million, including about $200,000 in administrative costs for the department to administer. Chicky, do you want to talk a little bit about the process we went through to...
So good afternoon, Representative Greenlick and members of the committee. As mentioned by...
Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Chicky Flowers. I am the project manager for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. And the process that we adopted was very collaborative. We had invited members of the different COFA nations, as well as members of the legislature, insurance companies, consumer advocacy groups, and other state agencies, and also the Oregon Health Authority. And together we met several times throughout the last few months since the passage of HB 2522. And we also formed a very formal advisory group of 15 members, equally represented by the different stakeholder groups. And through those meetings and the different extensive communications we had with the different stakeholders, we were able to put together a report that would provide a program to about 1,000 to 1,500 COFA residents in Oregon who would be eligible for this program because they are not eligible for Medicaid. And what would be, if there's enough funding available, we would be able to provide a program, or rather a program that provides plans that will provide a better coverage, better than a platinum plan for these COFA residents.
Are you going to come forward with that plan as a part of the marketplace?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, sir?
Are you going to come forward with, will that plan be a part of the marketplace, or will it require
exactly,
a different
sir.
Waiver?
So all
or?
These plants will be sold through the marketplace. They are cost-sharing reduction variants of the silver-level plants that are currently and will be available in the exchange for 2017 and onwards.
Let me just add to that a little bit. I think the issue will be if you collectively choose to provide that level of funding by whatever mechanism, and there are a number that we could probably talk about, we would be able to design a vehicle that would be offered through the marketplace to be able to meet that need.
So it'll come forward to us as a part of your budget proposal? Is that the...
No. We would expect that there would be a need for a bill to want to go ahead and fund to fund a program, and then we can design a program that would deliver that funding.
Is somebody putting that bill forward?
We're not as an agency bill right now.
I think it's Representative Olson.
Representative Olson and the different advocacy groups are putting together a COFA healthcare.
We have among the three bills we have now, and we're down to three, so we don't have to have much discussion. One would combine the basic health plan with the 1332 waiver request that you made as a single bill, and we've confirmed that that can happen. But this is not necessarily a part of that bill, so I was wondering.
This is not a part of that bill, sir. This is a separate endeavor, but we are aware of these other initiatives, and we will work in tandem.
Well, I just want to make sure there's a bill coming forward for that.
It's a personal bill of Representative Olson.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay, that's all I was saying.
Cool.
I wanted to make sure we didn't miss something.
Right.
Representative Olson's gone now. Right?
Yes.
Okay.
We would be happy to answer any other questions you have regarding our recommendations report.
Question, please, Chair.
Bueller has a question.
Yes.
Thanks, Chair Greenlink. I see in your report that a couple of your key assumptions on the cost of the program is the size of the household and the health of the individuals who would be insured. Have you done a sensitivity analysis on if you're off on those estimates, what the difference would be?
Representative Greenlink, Representative Bueller, the sensitivity analysis, can you expound further on what the difference would be?
How would it change if all participants didn't live in a one-person household?
The change would be in terms of budget, the amount would be a lot less. Oh, so the projections provided in this report is the maximum scenario. Okay. It assumes 100% uptake on day one, full 12 months of eligibility, everyone lives in a one-person household, and everybody takes advantage of the maximum out-of-pocket costs.
In short, our sensitivity analysis was every place there was a choice to make, we went high.
Okay. That's what. Thank you.
Okay. Great.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Very well done, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that your request will be in that bill on the basic health plan as well.
Okay.
Okay, let's move to a brief report on the basic health plan.
Martin Taylor, Janet Bauer, please.
Turns you off. You have the whole 10 minutes you asked for.
Thank you. We are grateful.
You got five. That's
right. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share the recommendations for program design for our basic health program in Oregon. I want to start first with context. As you may know, consumer advocates in Oregon have been focused on finishing the work of health reform for several years. Several years ago, we formed the Inclusion, Affordability, and Innovation Coalition to address remaining gaps. In 2014, we worked with you to pass a feasibility study of a basic health to see if this option under federal law could offer modest income households a high quality coverage package that they could afford. The results of the study by Wakely and the Urban Institute were promising. This past session, we worked with you to take the next step. To have a group of stakeholders work at designing a basic health program that would help those modest income households at little or no cost to the state. That resulted in HB 2934. Since June, with the help of staff at the Oregon Health Authority, consumer advocates sat at a table with industry stakeholders to hammer out a design framework. I served on that stakeholder work group, and I'm happy to say I believe we were successful. Martin Taylor and I are here today to tell you about our work and briefly about the design structure that we recommend. So I'll turn things over to Mr. Taylor.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing CARE Oregon as the Director of Public Policy and Community Relations, and I'll just, my colleague Jeremiah gave you the long pitch about who we represent, so just footnote that. First off, I want to acknowledge that while CARE Oregon's been a very interested observer in the conversation around basic health plan, our message to the consumer advocates until this report has been, you show us what a basic health plan really looks like and we'll evaluate it and decide if that's something that CARE Oregon can support. I am here in support of the basic health plan proposal shown in the report that you have today. I think it's a really important transition from having a group that is a consumer group identifying a consumer need to now having tested that against a work group, a state agency, and a variety of stakeholders to suggest there is a way to do this that could be cost neutral to the state, achieve really significant advantages for the consumer population, and move forward healthcare reform. So in this slide deck, I'm not going to take you through the stakeholder process. You can see that on the screen. But I will say that under the design principles, with the help of industry stakeholders, we identified three categories of principles. First, consumers would have to be benefited through increased access to coverage, and we did cover both the COFA population and then the folks in the five-year ban. The short version of that is that 87,000 Oregonians would be eligible for a product like this based on income in 2016. Wakely's estimate is that something in the 60 to 70,000 range would take it up, and of those, let's see if I got the number here, between 54,000 and 9,900 would be, 5,400 and 9,800 would be newly insured people. So this is a significant group of newly insured folks. The second is that it would have to increase the affordability of coverage for low-income Oregonians. And the third for consumers is that we would reduce churn by minimizing and mitigating the frequency of churn. Those are three pretty significant consumer advantages, and you should know that under federal law, the basic health plan actually requires that people get a product that's as good or better than they get on the exchange for a price or cost share that is better than they get on the exchange, and that they are required to have choice of plans. So there's really built into basic health plan no way for the consumer to lose. The next question is, from a public policy standpoint, what are the principles that you as lawmakers should be looking at? We came up with these, that there should be a sponsor for an accountable care model using a measurement framework to incentivize quality and population health improvements. That became our long-winded way of saying we're going to want the basic health plan to follow the same formula as the coordinated care model that now exists in CCOs and in PEB and in some of the products offered in OWEB. The belief being that you have spent a lot of time as policymakers in healthcare reform creating levers to improve healthcare, and all public money should be investing in those levers. So this is a population that you can expand that to. The next is that you would be able to promote a sustainable and predictable rate of growth. Just as in PEB and in the CCOs, there's now an established 3.4% rate of growth from year to year. You would use a similar tool to manage the rate of cost growth in the basic health plan. Finally, the question was, what was the impact going to be on the marketplace? Ultimately, this report puts the basic health plan in the federal marketplace as a way of being a market stabilizer. There are certainly questions about if Oregon's federal marketplace. split those terms as you will, but the point is that rather than removing the basic health plan population from the marketplace, creating some concern that it might destabilize the marketplace, we left them there and actually believe that there might be, through the basic health plan, some ability to stabilize. There's a lot of questions in that. We want to, essentially, the work group said, instead of assuming the marketplace to be harmed, let's see if there's some way that we can use basic health plan to stabilize the marketplace. And then, obviously, to exercise stewardship of scarce state resources by maximizing the federal resources available through the ACA. So those are the principles we looked at. I'm going to let Janet describe the design of the plan and then probably end early on the presentation side so you have time for a few questions.
Great. Thank you very much. I will be brief. I will go through some key points of our design. The delivery system was one of the first things we debated. And as Martin has intimated, we went with an interesting option. Instead of opting for a program operated either through the Oregon Health Plan or the commercial market, we found a way to build on the strengths of each, and this is how it would work. So we would invite CCOs to offer a product in the marketplace, and in addition, we would invite commercial insurers to do the same. All basic health programs would conform with Oregon's coordinated care model, and so that that has several advantages that Martin will talk about in a minute. About the benefit package, we opted for the more protective Medicaid benefit package without adult dental. I want to say just a word about adult dental. We had unanimity about the desire to include adult dental in this package. We also were committed to presenting recommendations for a structure that Oregon could operate a program within the federal dollars coming to the state. Based on the Wakely study, the estimated federal dollars were not enough to cover the adult dental. So that accounts for our recommendation. However, we did observe that the study is dated. It would need to be updated, and there is reason to believe that there may be more federal dollars coming to Oregon for this plan than anticipated by the report. We would need to do an update. And should there be federal dollars, the first thing we would recommend would be to add adult dental. We discussed provider reimbursement, and it's on the previous slide, just if we want to follow along. And the issues obviously were assuring that there would be provider interest in this program. So we recommend having provider reimbursements above the Medicaid level, approximately halfway between Medicaid and commercial insurance rates, which turn out to be slightly above Medicare reimbursement rates. I think that those providers who participated had stayed at the table for that discussion. Okay. And in terms of consumer costs, for premiums and cost sharing for individuals who are below 138% of the federal poverty level and would otherwise have been eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, we structured costs identical to the Oregon Health Plan. In other words, there wouldn't be premiums and there wouldn't be cost sharing. But for those folks above that level, up to 200%, we would have a graduated premium schedule that would impose premiums at levels below those in the marketplace. So the product would be more affordable. Secondly, there would not be cost sharing to access services. There would not be deductibles that currently are obstacles for individuals getting care. They can be. The enrollment and eligibility would be handled by the marketplace. They would conform with the open enrollment period, and there would be 12-month eligibility period before redetermination as it exists now for individuals in the marketplace. We note that there's consumer choice, which is a requirement of the federal law. Administrative functions would be handled by the marketplace and by carriers. That would include a collection of premiums. And lastly, we do recommend a sustainable growth rate as a feature of the program, as an important component of the coordinated care model. So I'm going to stop there, and those are the highest level recommendations. There's narrative about the issues that we discussed on each one of these things and how we came up to came to the recommendations. But I'm going to turn things over to Martin to check about whether there's other comments he would want to make about advantages and disadvantages of this particular model.
As you
model.
Wrap this up, will you also tell us, I think there's an intention to request, it's one of us, a piece of one of our three bills, to request that OHA develop the blueprint for this? Or?
Yes, that is the request. And I would say the advantage and disadvantages are on the PowerPoint slide. You can see them. I've covered them. I'd really rather leave just a few minutes for questions. I realize we caught you at the end of a very long day, but clearly this is interesting because you stayed. So any other questions you have?
Is this viewed as a 1332 waiver?
Oh, that is a great question. I had this conversation just the other day with Deanna Gilmore from DCBS. At this point, you could do either, but it probably makes more sense to do a 1332 waiver.
I think in the bill we'll just talk about waivers rather than specific ones, because it also relates to, the bill will relate to a 1332 question that DCBS wants us to take to. It'll be a little complicated bill.
That would make sense.
Can I just say a quick comment?
Yeah.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yeah.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So I served on this committee. I learned a lot about it. I went into it conceptually wanting to support basic health plan because I think it's really important to make to figure out every single tool to cover more of a population than is currently covered with health insurance, but didn't know how we would make it work. And I think the committee did an incredible job of going through it with insurance, with providers, with marketplace operators, everyone at the table. People had varying levels of excitement around a variety of the different proposals put forward. But I think in terms of making it more affordable for people all the way from 0 to 200%, reducing churn, driving, using this as an opportunity to drive healthcare delivery connected to coverage more toward a coordinated and preventative model, those things are very exciting to me. And, if you're going to take 95%, if you're going to take what has currently going to subsidies for the 138 to 200% of the market and say you only get 95% of it and you're going to spread it among more people, I think the idea of trying to hit the provider reimbursement at 81% is very reasonable, because that means that people that were in the commercial market, the providers are not so happy because they've been getting 100%. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people out there that are basically charity care for which they're getting nothing. And that was, we thought, if we bring way more people into the market and those providers are getting 81%, then we think it's going to come out ahead. But a lot of this was conceptual. It is very important that we have a bill that allows us to do a blueprint so that we can have the actual numbers and get that updated. And I will say that, there was a lot of concern about making sure that we don't shake a very fragile marketplace, but the number of people between 138 and 200% of poverty currently in the marketplace is very low. I think it was a third of those eligible.
40%.
40%. Okay, so it's very low because it's not affordable. So if by putting it in the marketplace and allowing the broker fees to continue, we actually bring a lot more people into the marketplace. So I just wanted to touch on a lot of the concerns that I've been hearing over time and how I think this committee did an incredible job of addressing every single one of them.
I was very skeptical going in, as I think all you know. I said,
still skeptical.
Show me. And I think the committee did a pretty good job of showing. We'll see.
Question? One quick comment?
Yeah.
Chair Green, just one quick comment. I know
you're not going to talk about adult dental.
No, I'm going to talk about Dr. Bueller. Teaches us that the head bone's connected to the neck bone. I might add
to
that, and onto the backbone, the hip bone, that the jawbone's actually connected to the head bone. So I'd like to see that adult dental.
Oh, yes,
we would too. Yes.
I wondered where that was going.
Okay, again, just for the record, we didn't need to spend much time because we ended up with three bills asked for, which is what our limit was. One is coming in from the board, the Oregon Medical Board, to talk about the impaired physician program to try and do it differently. One is going to be about optometry and the relationship with optometric insurance to try and finish up some things that we started last time. And the third will be a combination of a bill asking for the basic health plan blueprint and also proposing giving DCBS authority for 1332 waivers. So they'll seem to fit nicely together.
And I need to make one comment.
Yes, please, make whatever comment you need. You've done all the work up till now.
Committee members, on OLAS, there's an acknowledgement letter on a legislative update on House Bill 3396, which was the bill that moved out of revenue that related to the rural tax, the rural health care provider tax credit for 2 years, and it did some other things. They were required to report. Oregon Health Policy Board did it. I'm just acknowledging that the committee received it. It's online, and it just shows their timelines and what they're going to do future. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Anything for the, for the order?
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
I'm just confused by your financial projections. It's quite a contrast to the last example, which was extremely well done with sensitivity analysis and things. But this, you say the projections range from a deficit of 1.6 to 119 million. Where are, that's quite a delta.
It is. Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I'm glad you asked that. That data is from the Wakely Report, and it represents the findings of four different scenarios that were modeled. The one that produces the lowest deficit is the sort of skimpiest, well, it has provider reimbursement rates at Medicaid level and a smaller benefit package. And the largest deficits occur with commercial reimbursements and an OHP package. So the benefit of the of that analysis was that it helped us understand where the costs were coming in. It was sort of done by design. I'm not sure that we thought we would implement any one of those, but it really gave us, those were the variables that we wanted to see tested.
Sort of sensitivity analysis.
Yes.
Representative Bueller, if I may. Just ever so quickly, there was a 2014 data that Wakely was looking at. They gave us a range of scenarios. The committee considered the scenarios and tried to find one that would produce a budget neutral environment for you as policymakers. To be honest, this numbers, all of them would have to be reshot before you would authorize a bill to implement basic health plan, and that would probably not take place till 2018. So rather than going back and reshooting the numbers, which will be obsolete by 2018, we said, look, we really modeled the model that was most likely to get you there, but you're going to have to take a look at the actual numbers closer to implementation.
I question another assumption you're making. So how many other states have a plan like this?
There are two other states, Minnesota and New York, who operate a basic health program at this time. They have currently covering existing, previously covered adults. So they have self-financed the program until the federal dollars could be realized. Those would not be, the Affordable Care Act allowed implementation starting in 2016.
And what would prevent Oregon from being a magnet state for people to come to get these benefits as opposed to staying in their existing state and not having insurance or paying for it?
Right. I think that issue is broader. It's broader than the basic health program. There are states that have not expanded Medicaid. We could look at seeing what kinds of migration there's been as a result of that. I haven't heard that that's occurred, but it is a great question, and that would need to be looked at. So
I'm going to interrupt. We're running late. Sure. We have a caucus to go to on our side. Late for. Thank you very much.
You.
And all of these groups that have done all this work that we heard today, I really need to tell you how much we admire and how much we appreciate the work that's been going on. It's really in the public interest. That's been great. We are adjourned. Okay.